everyone. Welcome back to Not About the Weather. This episode is a special focus on a very special book called Ship It by Britta London. And you may have heard us talk about it in various forms before now, may have seen it doing the rounds on the internet. So like our Harry Potter episode of last year, or maybe even the year before, this is a intensive focus on just this book. And we're going to give you our hypes and gripes about it and what it made us feel. And we're also featuring an interview with Britta herself, which was done when the book was released in May. The reason we're doing the Ship It episode now is because the Ship It audiobook comes out on 21st of August. So that is an interesting situation where usually when a book is sort of known that it's going to be a hit, or I don't know, just that the publisher is preparing for it, audiobook is released at the same time. But because this is a debut novel, I guess maybe they didn't know whether they definitely wanted to do an audiobook. It was picked up for an audiobook, which is being released this week here in August with two different narrators for the two different perspectives in the book, which is very cool. So we're circling back to talk about Ship It. And you can get the novel or the audiobook. We'll provide some links to that in the show notes. But without further ado, we are going to get into it. This week, I am joined by Brittany, who you all know. So hello, Brittany.
Hello.
And we're also joined by Cass, who you do not know, who is a friend of mine from fandom. And she's got some pretty sick fandom cred. And this book is also... also, you know, very relevant to her. So I decided to bring together a couple of different perspectives to talk about the book. If you would like to follow us on our social media, you can do that on our Twitter, which is at NATW Podcast. We also have that address on Instagram, Facebook, or natwpodcast@gmail.com if you want to write in. Our website is notabouttheweatherpodcast.com. You can see all of our episodes there and read the full show notes, get the links to any of the resources that we mention. You can also follow that website through Tumblr. It has a connection through to Tumblr, so you can follow that with a Tumblr account and send us an ask if you'd like to. That is where you can find us if you so wish to do that. And now that I'm saying that, I'm remembering that I forgot to do that on last week's episode that Brittany and Mitch were on with me. So that's where you can find us, NATW Podcast, pretty much on everything. And that is where we are. I'll also get Cass to just tell us a bit about herself and her experience in the world and fandom. I will start by saying that Cass is someone that I met through Supernatural, and she is what the kids call a BNF. Cass has some very popular fan fictions of the Supernatural variety, like, you know, ones that come up in the very top hits and recommendations and searches, however you choose to curate your AO3 experience, which is another reason that I was interested in bringing her on, because of the perspective of Claire in this book being a massively popular fan fiction writer in her chosen fandom. Cass is also at the moment curating a fan fiction, what do you call it, challenge/festival, like a fan fiction thing where people can submit things. So you can tell us about your real world and fandom experience in however you want to express that in a way that's not me. I stalked Cass until she became my friend, because she she wrote both. One of her fan fictions was the first Supernatural fan fiction I found on my own that appealed to me, that, like, I'd had a lot of recommendations, but this is like browsing things and the way that, you know, the tone of the introduction and all of it is like, that's the kind of quality and tone that I look for in other fandoms. That one's for me. And then I also found Meta that Cass wrote on Tumblr, that was also one of the funniest and smartest and least histrionic pieces I'd seen. And then I realized that those two things were by the same person. Then I stalked her until she became my friend. So that's what happened.
Right. Yeah. Which is a great way to make friends, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, with my interpretation aside, please feel free to introduce yourself, and if people want to get in touch with you or whatever you want to say about yourself.
Yeah. My name's Cass, obviously, but I go by Violet Matter on Twitter and Imogen by Night on AO3. And yeah, so I've been involved in the Supernatural fandom since sort of roughly season 6 was airing. It's my first online fandom that I ever participated in, and pretty much the only one that I really participate in. Not my first fandom. I think that would have been X-Files and Buffy, but that was always a thing that I did on my own. So yeah, so I've been around fandom for a while, but only participating really for about 7-8 years, something like that. And yeah, as Nat said, I'm running a fanfic challenge. It's the Deancast Pinefest, which is coming up into its 3rd year at the moment, which you can find at deancastpinefest.tumblr.com. Yeah, that's probably just about everything.
And the sign-ups are open now.
They are, yes. Yeah, sorry, so sign-ups are open. Authors can sign up until September 3rd, and artists can sign up until November 30th. So there's still plenty of time.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll go into this because there's a lot of context about, you know, about this, you know, in various ways. So that's us. You know, Brittany is here with me, and Brittany doesn't talk too much about her shipping and fandom experience, aside from like the kind of stuff that we joke about on Rewatchable. But I do know that she's, you know, she's got a secret, more fanish life than she would let on. So I am curious. The first time I ever met Brittany, which may have been her friend's influence, but the first time I ever met Brittany was at a coffee shop that was a large factor of a Glee fan fiction that we had both read.
That is true.
So that is like the context. Yeah, it is true. And so that is the context of, you know, some context of our lives. But what we'll do now is we'll play the interview that I did with Britta. So it's just me and Britta talking for about 45 minutes about the book and her experience and her fandoms. And then we'll come back to us and we'll talk about the book and our experiences and our fandoms. So, you know, also, you know, what we have to say about the interview. So we'll see you in 45 minutes. Bye. I guess, first of all, like, what made you want to put this out in the world, / who is it for? Is this something that you wanted to give back to the people that, you know, see themselves in it, or is this something that you wanted to shine a light on for civilians, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I totally know what you mean. And I feel like I kind of wanted the audience to be both people in fandom and people who had never encountered fandom before. I grew up obsessed with, my first fandom was the X-Files in like grade 7, grade 8, was when I first got into it. And at that time, like all of fandom really existed like in weird online communities, like in dark corners of the internet and like GeoCities pages. And it wasn't something that you talked about in school, or certainly not in public where like cool kids could hear you. And it wasn't something that you like advertised, the fact that like you read fan fiction on the internet. So, I grew up where fandom was this thing that was like a dirty little secret or something maybe to be embarrassed of. And I really didn't want that kids today to feel like they had to feel that way, especially if they were reading gay fan fiction. And so part of why I wanted to write the book was so that, to like kind of bring it into the light and make sure that it wasn't, I just don't want it to feel fandom to feel like something people have to be embarrassed of. I don't want like loving a television show to be something embarrassing. But at the same time, like part of that is, making it accessible or understandable to a different audience. And so, you know, the book is written from two perspectives, from Claire's perspective, she's a teenage fangirl, and from Forrest, who's one of the actors being shipped in the gay ship. And Forrest's chapters are all about him, like, starting to learn to understand fandom and come to, like, at first he thinks it's weird or dumb or dorky or whatever. And he sort of learns why it's important and why it's kind of a magical, wonderful community. And so hopefully that is accessible to people who don't know anything about fandom, who can step into this book knowing nothing and, like, learn, you know, in the first 20 pages you learn what shipping is. And then by the end, hopefully you are shipping things, you know, like you, like, fully are in the community by the end of reading the book.
Yeah, I personally think it is the best example so far in popular media of actually translating that experience. And I guess I'm curious, I'm not a teen, but apparently the kids, they all have, they all do it at school and stuff now. Maybe, obviously your book is talking about a circumstance where it is a very insular, community for Claire, that she doesn't have that. But, apparently, they go and they do this at school. And, yeah. And I can't imagine what that would have been like. But the point is, what I'm trying to say is, do you think that we're going to see more, obviously you write on Riverdale.
Yeah.
Portrayals of teenagers in the media. When is this going to become, a normal portrayal, if you know what I mean, what the teen experience is like? Because the internet, social media means that anything that you like now, it is more of a lifestyle, and you obviously also see fandom being diluted. It is more wide reaching, and it is diluted in some areas of people being casually invested in fandom, whereas in our day you had to find it, so
was a little bit more of a barrier to entry.
Think, just as a total tangent, in your experience writing for teens and writing with about teens, do you think this is going to be something that the when we look at a teen TV show, is this an aspect that's going to be like a day-to-day life, like someone else who's in the, football or whatever?
Right, right. Well, I hope so. I mean, I think you see more and more portrayals in a casual way coming up. John Green's latest book, Turtles All the Way Down, which was not a book about fandom, included a character who wrote fan fiction. And it was just sort of like a casual, not even a B plot. It was like a D plot.
Yeah.
To that book, and it just felt like it was sort of organically layered in this way that was nice. But to answer your question about whether it's still socially acceptable now, I think that fandom has become much more socially acceptable, but there's still different kinds of fandom. And I think, for example, on Riverdale, I on Twitter and Tumblr and stuff, I connect and hear from a lot of fans who ship, for example, Bughead, which is the Betty Jughead ship, or Varchie, which is the Veronica Archie ship. Both of those are canon, hetero ships. Mm. And there's tons and tons of fans who talk about them every day and tweet at me and tumble at me and all that jazz. I don't really hear from people who ship, say, Archie and Jughead. Or, I heard a little bit from Betty and Veronica fans in the first season, a little less now. It's not that popular. And our show isn't a show with a hugely popular non-canon gay ship the way that some other, the way the show is in the book, Ship It.
Yeah.
But still, I think there is a difference between somebody who ships a canon straight couple. That, I think, is very mainstream and very understandable. You love this couple on
chat. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. If you're the person being no, can't you see Jughead and Archie are in love? I think that's when you start to get the head cock and the weird looks, and people are like, no, you believe things that aren't true. You're in fantasy land. This isn't reality. And that's the kind of, when people roll their eyes and kind of brush you aside and okay, you're hysterical. That's kind of what I wanted to write about with Ship It. And I feel like those feelings probably aren't as mainstream.
Yeah. I don't know I want to go pretty much all the way down, but it's so, for me, this was one of the most stressful experiences of my life, just reading it. So I cannot imagine for you writing it as a lifelong fandom immersed person, what this was like, what did you want to avoid? Because ultimately, for me, what made this book so incredible was the climax and the acceptance. Obviously, not everything turns out as you would want it to. We still have the party of the showrunner and stuff like that. It doesn't all just work out. But there is a validation in the closing of the book that, for example, I don't want to drag this book at all because I actually really liked it. But Fangirl by Rainbow Rowell does not have a it basically the ending is that she moves on from it. Like the girl mm-hmm. kind of moves on from her fandom experience and writing fic and stuff like that. And that, you know, the journey is valid, but the ending is that is a growth away from that. And yours mm-hmm. is not that. And I did like that book for what it was, but this was very different for me in the lesson learned when you close the book is a very different one. So yeah. what was important about that to you, and like what did you want to avoid, you know, showing civilians yeah. about fandom or stuff like that?
Yeah, it was there's a lot of there's more and more books about fandom now, but there still aren't that many. And there aren't that many about gay fandom in the way that I was writing about it. And so I felt a huge pressure to portray the community authentically and in a way that people would look at and feel proud of if they were a member of that community. And if they weren't a member of the community, didn't know anything about it, they would look at it and understand a little more. And there's just like a lot of political pressure on the story beyond trying to tell a good story with good characters, with great conflict, with good drama that is going to be memorable, like all of the things that you're usually worried about when you're writing a book. Like on top of that is like all of this political stuff of like trying to have good representation and all of that stuff. And so it was a lot of pressure, but you know, it felt important to me, and it was a story that I felt was needed to be written. And so what I did was just I talked to a lot of other people who were in the same community. I talked to a lot of fans. It was a screenplay before it was a book.
Yeah, yeah.
And so as a screenplay, I had sent it to dozens of fans, friends of mine, friends of friends, even just like people on the internet who had heard about it and wanted to read it and help out. I would send it to them and be like, tell me if anything feels off or weird to you. And originally in I'll try to talk about this without getting too spoilery, but the original ending to the screenplay was much more optimistic and kind of a wish fulfillment fantasy.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Yeah. And in talking to a friend, she helped me realize that, that by doing that, I was saying, hey, if you want your ship to go canon, all you have to do is X, Y, Z, yeah. and everything will work out. And I was like, oh yeah, that's not what I want to be saying. I don't want this to read as like a guidebook for how to make your ship go canon. Like, so in doing that, I gave it a more complicated, gray ending, which I hope is still satisfying, but also realistic. I mean, you know, it's not it's not a book that's obsessed with realism. So it's like you, as you're reading it, hopefully you get swept up in the story and it feels earned and it feels fun. But it's not necessarily a book that's, I would say, this is exactly how it all happens. But the other thing is like, I also wouldn't want anyone, I think if the events in this book were to actually take place, the reason why it's satisfying to read it, and this is maybe a little spoilery, so maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not worth talking about, but the ending, I think, mostly works because it's told in first person and we're inside everyone's heads. So we understand exactly what they're trying to do when they're doing it, and we understand their intentions. And if the events of this book were to actually happen, I think there would be, oh my God, so much fandom discourse and people who understood what the person was trying to do and people who didn't understand yeah. or took it the wrong way or had an ungenerous reading of the events. And I think it could actually have been like a giant mess, like just a clusterfuck.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's the thing. I'm sure for people in the Ship It universe that like someone at home is just like, this has ruined their entire experience of the show yeah. or this is like, totally, like what I wanted desperately the whole book was I'm like, can you please rewrite the entire book for me from Rico's perspective? That is what I was reading. I was just like, oh shit, like, and just like so much of that kind yeah. of thing of like, there's so many factors of the book that are really really honest portrayals of different people's you know, experiences in a fandom community. And obviously he's there as one of the ideals of like what you want from the people you know, participating in your community. And then obviously Forrest is a very honest portrayal of someone who really does not have the knowledge of what they're doing, like of what they've stepped into. And it's all stuff that we've seen like so many times before.
Right. Yeah.
So Forrest's journey felt like something I knew about or could, you know, felt like, okay, yeah, this is realistic to me. The biggest punch in the gut for me was actually with Claire, because I was reading it and it's, this is leading to a question, reading it, and we've got Forrest making the mistakes that we all know a Forrest would make.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sort of meant to be, you know, we start out on Claire's side, basically. And I was reading it, and, you know, the real low point in terms of the arc for me is Claire writing the RPF about him after she knows him. And I'm like, oh, fuck, because someone, I have known someone who tried to do that. And just, and it's, and I'm just like, oh, okay, yeah, obviously if Forrest is going to the lowest, he can go as in his position. Claire also has to go to the lowest. She can go in her position. So my question is basically, how hard was it for you, or how, you know, what was it like for you trying to create and portray these real horrible mistakes that you would never want to see a fan doing, or that you would never want to see an actor doing?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because, you know, as a fan myself, I think the first draft of this story was very rosy-eyed about who Claire was and what she was doing. And it would have been an easy trap to fall into, to have Claire be, you know, this righteous advocate for queer representation on TV without making any mistakes herself. And it's funny, I've seen critique of the book already online where people say, oh, Claire's a terrible person. She does so many bad, awful things during the course of the book. And it's like, yes, she does. She does. She makes mistakes. She goes too far. She gets carried away. She's 16 years old and she does some terrible things that she regrets by the end. And, you know, when she's older, she'll look back and cringe and be like, what was I thinking? But that's kind of what we do when we're 16 years old. At least that's what I did. I did a lot of that when I was 16 years old. So I definitely wanted to push that and show that, you know, I have a lot of love for fandom and I think it's a wonderful, creative, passionate, enthusiastic place. And I'm happy when I'm in it. But it doesn't mean that fandom never makes any mistakes. Like, certainly there are fans who go too far, across the line, invade privacy. And so one of the things I wanted to do is, show Claire, you know, I don't have a problem with RPF in general. I think it's I know there's a lot of discourse around it, but I think RPF usually is fans writing about the fictionalized personas that actors put forward or band members put forward. But what Claire does is she's not writing about a fictionalized persona. She's writing about the real person who she knows.
Yeah.
And that is where she crosses the line. And so she apologized at the end of the book. And I wanted to make clear that her apology is, I should never have written these things about you once I knew who you were. I should never have taken this stuff that you told me in private and put it into fanfic. She's not apologizing for RPF. She's apologizing for her specific actions. And so that was like an important distinction for me to make.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I got from it too. Like it was there were a lot of casual validations in the book of stuff like RPF, even like casual validation of incest fic, which is like a huge thing in most fandoms, but like as soon as you step outside the bubble, they're like, what? And they're like, no, this is just normal to us. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Lots of casual validations that I loved. But yeah, that abuse of power, you know, from her, not abuse of power from her, but abuse of access from her was like, I was just like, oh, like, I think I said something out loud. I was just like, oh, shit. So basically watching those really huge, like, the biggest possible mistake she could make in exchange for the biggest possible mistake that he made was, yeah, as I said, very stressful. The validation at the end of the day, I do think is pretty perfect in that, yes, obviously we would like things to be, you know, we would like a showrunner to be receptive in the way that, you know, we would want them to be, which we've seen happen with some, you know, we've seen happen with some shows where, you know, a showrunner has just, you know, changed the course of their intention because they realized that a take was actually pretty right. And then mm-hmm. some people who would just, you know, deny to the, you know, to the very end or, so, you know, and again, in Jamie, we have the worst of the worst in that, you know, he knew what he was doing, but was not actually, you know, he was doing it for the worst possible, you know, reasons. But I think that the end is, you know, is as fulfilling as it could possibly be without that rosiness that you mentioned,
yeah.
the unrealistic or the you know, manual to hitting a showrunner over the head until he, you know, holding the show hostage until it gives you what you want, which is not really what the audience should be doing.
Right.
Anyway, I don't know if I even have a question on all of that. The ending was, when I started the book, I just had no idea how you would possibly finish it in a way that was not either a total crushing or a total rosy ending. And what you found yeah. was the most perfect melding of you know, a validation that I could have never dreamed of. So kudos for that. But
oh, thank you so much.
But it was just, I never would have expected that ending, and it was just perfect.
Could I talk about one thing about that ending, which is that one of the things I struggled with a lot was that Claire is someone who, so she's got this queer ship that she wants to go canon and she's trying to make it go canon. And then one of the things I wanted to pick apart was the idea that if you once you have fandom and fanfic, whether or not something goes canon at a certain point sometimes is beyond the point. Like for me, I have certain ships that will never go canon. And like at this point, I've accepted that and I've read hundreds and hundreds of versions in fanfic of the story of the two characters falling in love and finally kissing and finally acknowledging their feelings. And like whatever version of that the show would ever, if they did it, which they wouldn't, whatever version of that the show would finally put on the air wouldn't compare to a lot of the versions of the stories that I've already read and love. And so it's almost like at a certain point, canon is beyond the fact, like, I don't need your validation of my ship to know that these characters are in love. I don't need the showrunner to say, oh, okay, I see it your way. Yes, they're in love. Like in my heart, I don't need that anymore. But the part that I do need is to see these queer characters on TV and to take and the revolutionary idea of taking people previously assumed were straight and being like, oh, actually, he's bisexual. Oh, actually, she's pansexual. Like all of these people who you thought were straight were queer. Like, deal with it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the revolutionary thing. And what I don't need my ship to go canon for there to be more queer characters on TV. And I think sometimes Claire and sometimes fandom has trouble pulling those two ideas apart. Like, yes, I want more queer representation. Also, I want my ship to go canon, but those are two different things, and we can have more queer representation without like my specific ship being canon. Do you know what I mean?
I totally get you. I'll text you something after this finishes. But I was just very recently in the middle of a little bit of some real misguided representation talk of ad that was just, I've been doing this for a long time and this one still boggled me. But anyway, point is, Demon Heart itself is obviously, you know, it's a conglomeration of a great many, you know, an identical conglomeration of a lot of major fandoms, major shipping fandoms, you know, all, you know, there's like a chromosome of each in the DNA, in the DNA of it. But what was your biggest inspiration? Because I see there's so many elements of a bunch of them. Like, I see there's obviously in this one there's the fact that it's like a first season show, so there's like they're still on the cusp of it. There's like little like the little statement between the guys is like very Steve and Bucky. There's like a lot of there's like I see the DNA of like a lot of like different elements of it. But yeah, so for you, like what, like, is there anyone that you would like not want to name and shame, like putting, you know, like, yeah, they're in there, like, or is it sort of just left to the imagination?
It's intentionally, you know, it's a genre TV show, on a small network. So it's intentionally meant to invoke whatever the reader's favorite ship is. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Is it Dean and Cass from Supernatural? Yes and no. Like, is it Teen Wolf? Yes and no. Like, is it Steve and Bucky? Yes and no. It's sort of, you know, is it Once Upon a Time? Like, yes and no. There's also like Hurt, who's the character, is a demon with a heart, and so he's basically like an angel.
I got like a bit of Spike and Buffy, a bit of Spike and Angel, and a bit of like I got like a lot of that dynamic in there as well. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it's just meant to be its own thing. Clearly, but like evocative of whatever your ship, whatever is like calling to you. If someone's like, this is definitely Teen Wolf, then sure, yes, it's Teen Wolf. Great, keep that.
Yeah. I found that very fun more than anything. The ship to end all ships kind of that was Demon Heart. But I don't know. It's yeah, it's or any like obviously you're also writing in this book you're writing behind the scenes of a television show. You're writing about like, you know, the PR aspect and you know what's the network aspect. You're writing, you know, people who work for the network who are who do believe this is a, you know, a direction the show would be taking. We've got people who write for the network that are the showrunner is obviously one thing. Then we've got the other showrunner that we meet, you know, on the same network who's, you know, a very different kind of person. Was there any kind of anything there that you had to intentionally sort of fictionalize to avoid people saying, what are they doing at the CW on where Britain works, you know, like, or is it a relatively honest portrayal of the mix of attitudes behind the scenes?
Yeah, I talked to a lot of people when I was writing this to try to get some real world authenticity in this. You know, like when I started writing this, I was an aspiring TV writer. And by the time I finished writing this and it's being published now, I am a TV writer. So I sort of knew how the writing happened. And I had that stuff figured out, but the PR and marketing aspects of it was stuff that I was asking a lot of questions about. So I have friends who work in that area. So I sat down and I had a bunch of questions for them, like, how does an actor get ushered around when he's at a Comic-Con? How much are you paying attention to them and how much are they free to like do whatever they want? What do the green rooms look like in the back? Can I go see one? There was a lot of that. There was a lot of real world anecdotes that my friends told me that I was like, do you mind if I fictionalize that and put that directly into the book? Like, there's a lot of the stuff in the book is real. Like there's a moment where Forrest is about to go out on stage for his first Comic-Con and someone stops him and is like, your t-shirt's not. What you're wearing isn't right for a Comic-Con audience here, and thrusts a new t-shirt at him and he has to put it on and walk out on stage. Like, that's a real story a friend of mine told me about, like, one of the actors that they saw just before they went out on stage was like, oh, your t-shirt's not nerdy enough, here, wear this instead. And then everyone looks at that person and assumes, oh, they're a big fan of whatever's on their t-shirt, when it really was something that was handed to them moments before they walked out.
I'd liked after the amount of time and my exposure on sort of both sides of the fence as well, that I can usually spot like when someone's put something on for an event or not, but there's still like a lot there of like, is someone's social media activity damage control or is it authentic, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. So are you worried about any questions that the behind the scenes stuff might raise, like in real fandom, like, or in your own life?
No, I mean, I think fandom benefits from a little bit of, I don't want to say media literacy because I think they're pretty literate in terms of the media, but in terms of like, how does TV production work? Like, how does the sausage really get made? I feel like sometimes fandom is sort of like hand wavy about that. They don't really care.
Oh, yeah.
Where if you're trying to draw conclusions about the show that you love and are obsessed yes. with, there you can learn a lot by just listening to some TV writing podcasts, listening to finding out like actually how do these shows get made, because it's way more complicated than it appears from the outside.
Top of the ladder is people who like expect, you know, that a show is written week to week, and that like that they that what they see one week is like changeable by the next week. That's like top of the ladder, but I've been talking about this a lot recently in terms of like people who write like a lot of meta purely about the narrative of the show. I'm like, that's great and I love it, but that's not what's actually like, if you want to know the driving factors are here, you have to look outside the narrative. You have to look at, like, yeah. who is in the writing room? Do they have a heteronormative viewpoint? Like, you know, yeah. if someone, you know, if an episode airs on TV, you know, who wrote it matters, you know? Like, who directed it matters, you know, yeah. what the actor's perspective matters. It's like, you know, if a line that you've analysed, you know, 10,000 words of meta on was written by someone who fully knows, you know, how it could be implied versus someone who literally didn't know that that's how it could be implied. And so,
yeah,
I find this sort of, this meta-analysis without, that's got the fourth wall closed. Mm-hmm. It's a great academic practice or whatever, but it's not mm-hmm. a predictionary tool. And so that kind of stresses me out a lot. But anyway, the point is, your book, you know, in your position as a TV writer, is it something that, you know, fans can read and get, they're reading it and you're okay with that perspective of their understanding of TV production being a fairly accurate one? Is that sort of what the aim is? Or is there anything that you are wanting people, given that they know who wrote it and where you work, is there anything mm-hmm. that you want to put your hand up and say, like, no, that is like a legitimate fictionalization of how stuff works?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of fudging here and there, but I think most of the fudging happens just in trying to get the timeline to work out. In trying to have the climax take place at San Diego Comic-Con, there's a little bit of like, you would really know whether the show was picked up by now, like before July.
That was
July.
The one thing that I was like, you wouldn't have a panel for a show that you don't know whether it's picked up or not. Anyway, yeah. That was the one thing that I did.
So that's the kind of fudging. Yeah. I think the stuff that has to do with like TV production, I think is pretty, I mean, most of it takes place at Comic-Con and there's not that much about TV production in the book, but I think most of it's pretty accurate. I tried to be as accurate as possible and use the lingo and talk the way that they would actually talk, even to the point where my copy editor was like, do you want to explain what this is in case people don't know this lingo? And so sometimes I explain and sometimes I'm like, it's fine. If they don't know what it is, it's fine. This is just how they would say it.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think that's there. I think the important part about TV production to me is, as Jamie, who's the showrunner, gives this speech maybe midway through the book where he talks about Claire is trying to hold him accountable for everything that happens in the show.
I actually really love this speech, even though he's a villain. Like, I really, really loved this. So,
I agree. Yeah, he's a villain, but he makes some good points in this speech where he talks about how you can try to hold him accountable for everything in the show, but ultimately he doesn't hold all of the reins of power. Like he is accountable to his bosses, who are the network executives or the studio executives. He's accountable to production, who has budgets that determine a lot of what he can and can't do, who can be in the scene, where they can shoot. The actors have ideas about what their characters are should say or what they should look like. There's so many different forces coming at him from all sides that is all he can do to just like make a television show. And on top of that, Claire has what he considers unreasonable expectations. Whether you agree with him, his viewpoint or not, is up to the reader. But I think it's a nice speech because it shows that he feels like, as a showrunner, his hands are tied and there's not that much he can do. I think he's not being generous enough about his own abilities when he says this stuff, but I think it is nice to remind fandom that not everything that hits the screen is like the purest expression of someone's creative vision. A lot of what makes it to the screen is just the best they could do under the circumstances or under a crunch time period or with the money they had available, or there was a hurricane bearing down and this is just what they got before it touched down. You know, like
there are so
many different pressures affecting television production and thousands of people working on it and millions of dollars that it's like, and you have to make 22 episodes a year. It's just, there's a lot going on. And so this is sort of like, this is the best we could do and please enjoy it.
Yeah. I definitely felt very strongly about that moment, you know, despite some of the other, you know, other more unforgivable moments, but honestly, I could probably talk about this for another 24 hours, like all of these different aspects. So I'm not quite sure where to close you off. But in terms of like real fandom and your fandom experience, you know, like what is, you know, what's your fandom DNA? Like what are, you know, you mentioned a few, you know, ships and stuff for Demon Heart, but you know, are there any of these experiences that Claire has or feelings that Claire has that really come directly from your experience? You know, whether it's about her own sexuality or her, you know, her shipping, you know, overall the message of the book is, you know, both one of her own exploration of why this was something she was invested in, which is, you know, true for a lot of people, and some people it is, you know, I think that there is a fairly big divide between queer people in gay shipping fandom and people who are not, and that there's a lot of dynamics there. But both that and the ultimate validation of the book being like, yes, this is a thing that happens on television. Yes, there are ships that, you know, this reading is not delusional, and the world would be better if those readings were allowed to develop, you know, like we saw with Hannibal is the biggest recent, recent one and that kind of thing.
So, or Legends of Korra.
Legends of Korra. And those kind of developments where, you draw the line between the fans dictating the show, but the showrunner being, open to these perspectives. Anyway.
Right.
Your own experiences into the book, the ones that have really shaped you, if you want to share any of them.
Well, my first fandom, as I said, was the X-Files, and I started out with Mulder Scully fandom because I think when you first start in fandom, shipping something that's not canon and never will be canon is, it takes it wasn't obvious to me that was even something that you could do until I was reading a lot of Mulder Scully fic, and I came across one that was a Mulder Krycek fic. You know, he's another dude on the show. And I was like, how could anyone ship Mulder and Krycek when he's so clearly meant to be with Scully and obviously not gay? And then I read it and I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. I understand. And I think that was my first time reading something that wasn't canon, would never be canon, was clearly just for fun, just the writer saying, what if? And it kind of opened my eyes to being like, oh, you don't have to follow the rules of the show. You can go outside of it. And I think my first time feeling that sort of like righteous anger that Claire feels of like, no, this should be canon. You're the crazy one for saying this shouldn't be canon, was watching House for the first time. When that show premiered, I was in college. I think it was a freshman or sophomore in college.
I mean, they ended it in a way that was canon enough for me, but like
the
end of that show. But yes, I just got chills you saying that, to be frank. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's something I feel like we don't quite talk about enough, but I started watching that show with everybody else who was in my dorm that year, and we would all gather in the social room and we would turn it on. I don't know why we were so into it, but I remember looking around and I made some crack, like episode 2 or 3, like, these guys are gay for each other. And everyone's like, ha ha, Britta. And then a little while later, like a few weeks later, being like, no, these guys are
This is the primary love story of this show.
Yeah, this is
like,
the love story.
And
that feeling of like everyone else being like, no, you're wrong, they can't be,
because
they're straight, because they're men, and me being like, no, no, it is, it's not I who am wrong, it is you. And that feeling was the first time I got righteous about it, and yeah. the first time I was like, no, 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 this isn't just for fun anymore. This isn't just Mulder Krycek crack fic. This is like a real thing.
Like, that no matter
be.
Where their dicks go, this is the narrative of the story.
This is it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm literally like about to cry. Sorry, carry on.
And so then once you have that, you can't go back, right? Yeah. Really. Like then once you've internalized that, it's like it becomes the way you see everything. And I remember shipping Sam and Josh on the West Wing, and just like all kinds of gay ships that my friends didn't understand or didn't like. And I also had straight ships and stuff, but yeah. And that, like, you know, up through college and into the present, into Tumblr fandom, where, you know, Dean and Cass like took over Tumblr there for a few years, a couple years back, and they were everywhere. And that's what got me to start watching Supernatural. And I was like waiting for Dean's boyfriend to show up and like, when does the gay love story happen? And then it started happening. I was like, I see the gay love story. Yes. Tumblr was not wrong. This is what was advertised. And then into this day, like now I think I'm a little more likely if there's enough queer characters on TV where I can like seek out the actual canon ship.
Yes.
So I'm really into like the bold type. Cause I like seeing actual queer women on TV instead of just like shipping, you know, ones that people tell me will never go canon. So that's nice. And I'm a little less attracted to the non-canon stuff, but I still get righteous about it.
No, fair enough. Yeah, I do think, you know, like that big, again, the speech, the other most affecting part of the book for me, besides the end, was the lesson that Claire gives Forrest about what happens. I also found it very interesting. The one track of the book that I found the most interesting was Forrest's own curiosity about what was going on with him and whether that was something that you were worried about including in any way in terms of the sort of damaging aspect of, like, you know, RPF conspiracy theory shipping. But
right,
that's another story. So I was just curious just about what your development of his arc was. But that lesson that she gives him about the difference between, like, some things are for fun and some things, you know, are important is just, like, I just think it's seminal. Like, I expect a lot of people quoting that post all, you know, like that speech all over the internet and stuff like that. So I guess, like, yeah, what do you most want, you know, people to take away from the book? You know, I tweeted you the other day about that Misha Collins tweet about, yeah, and I'm like,
you're not crazy.
You know, like, was that a direct, you know, like, to me, that's the biggest takeaway from book. And
yeah.
Is that sort of what you're, you know, at the end of the day, wanting to put out there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you're not crazy. You know, I try not to use crazy anymore, so it's used very occasionally in the book. And
I did like that call out as well.
Yeah, and it gets called out because it's like it's hard not to use this language because I feel like there's very few fangirls who ship gay ships who haven't been called crazy. So it feels like it's hard not to use that language. But yeah, that Misha Collins quote, you're not crazy, which still, like, I one day I hope we get the oral history of like what was actually happening behind the scenes during those years on Supernatural when the fandom was hitting a fever pitch, the oral history that we all deserve, like what was happening behind the scenes that led to Misha tweeting that. If Ship It is just it's just from my imagination, like similar events to what was happening on Supernatural of like what could be going through an actor's
yeah.
head leading to their own self-discovery. But yeah, I would love to hear that. I would love to hear about all of these things, what's going on behind the scenes. I would love to hear the One Direction, what was going on behind the scenes in that band, because that we deserve the oral history of those years as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe in another 20 years, we'll find out all of the gay shit that we didn't hear about. But yeah, what's the main takeaway I want people to when they, after reading Ship It? Yeah, I think there's a line that Forrest gives in his sort of closing speech that goes something like, you should never be made to feel ashamed for loving the things that you love. And that feels like that it feels like it applies not just to fandom, but also to any queer people who are sort of struggling with feeling like they're unsure about coming out or unsure about being themselves. Like, you should never let be made to feel ashamed for loving the things that you love. So that was sort of like the line that I hope resonates with people, and the idea that I hope resonates with people that it's okay to be in fandom. It's okay to ship this gay stuff. It's okay to advocate for it, and it's okay to be queer. And all of those ideas like go hand in hand. And there's a reason queer people want queer people on TV. Like, it helps you come to terms with your own identity when you can see other people going through it in fictional narratives. And so all of that is sort of like the root behind why I wrote this book in the first place.
Cool. Obviously, where we leave Forrest, he's about to start, you know, appearing on a show with a very different kind of showrunner. And we see, you know, Claire and Tess actively choosing to be a fan of that show because they have an inside track that this show is going to be gay, which was very, very resonant for me. And I was very recently explaining to someone how genuinely common the cliche of like, sounds gay, I'm in, is for, you know, gay people in fandom. Any good recommendations at the moment of you know, things that readers, you know, should seek out for? I mean, there's also the difference, because a non-canon ship is a build, you know, a build and a build, you know, a fantasy where, like you said, where it's, you know, the tension is a part of it. But, you know, in a canon ship is just like, you know, it can, you know, just become, well, not necessarily come easily, but it can, you know, once it's there, it's a very different kind of experience to be excited about. But what are some really good shows at the moment that are kind of the ideal, you know, ideal shipping fodder or ideal canon queer fodder for mm-hmm. the kids these days?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say my favorite right now is The Bold Type. There's a cat is a character who doesn't realize she's queer until she meets this lesbian character, Adina. The show follows three young women who like work at a Cosmo style magazine, and it's just really fun and contemporary and funny, and features like great female friendships. And the entire first season is Kat coming to terms with her new queer identity of being like, oh my God, I think I'm falling in love with a woman. Oh my God, I've fallen in love with a woman. What do I do about it? Oh my God. And her friends are there to help her every step of the way. And it's just wonderful. That's on Freeform. Another show, I don't know if you've heard of it. It airs Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. on the CW, and it's called Riverdale.
Oh, what? Who? What? Maybe.
season two, Riverdale. Cheryl Blossom, who was, I think, by many previously assumed straight, is revealed to be queer. And she gets a girlfriend, Tony Topaz, who's a self-sized serpent and a little bit more... a little tough, has a little dirt under her fingernails, like rides a motorcycle. And Cheryl's like a little bit more, well, she's Cheryl Blossom. She's one of a kind. and so that was like really important to me. And I'm really glad we got that onto the show. And their relationship is so much fun. And those actors are so much fun that I love writing for them.
I'll also just I'm not that familiar with the entire history of the Archie comics, and I know that you guys have obviously had, like, you know, your ups and downs in terms of what, you know, came through on the show. Was that character ever queer?
No, never. Okay, so this is just something we did for the show.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, which is cool. It is. That's the dream, is to take all of these iconic characters who were straight and one by one turn them queer until there's no one straight left.
You know, we have shows like, you know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which, you know, after four seasons, you know, takes a, you know, probably intended straight character and, you know, outs them. Always Sunny in Philadelphia after 12 seasons.
Yeah,
it does not seem like an impossible frontier, you know, it's sort of just matters who, you know, how many people will say yes going up the chain, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it gets easier and easier. It's certainly easier with secondary or tertiary characters than it is with your lead character. I think we still don't see enough shows where the main character is queer. But, you know, working on it. Someday Someday they'll all be queer. We're getting there.
I think that's a good point to leave it. I'll email you.
Okay, so we're back and we're going to go into our normal structure of the show where we tell you know, something we love and something we don't love about our life experience, which this week is going to be specifically directed at Ship It and the topics that it brought up for us. So we're going to do our gripes first. But first of all, I was just wondering if either of you had any particular discussion or thoughts about what Britta brought up in the interview.
So one thing that sticks out to me when reading anything about fandom and people who are older than me, who have been involved in fandom for many, many years, like since, you know, they were like the internet first came out and they were like joining chat groups and stuff like that. So I lived a very sheltered life in terms of internet exposure. Like, you know, there was dial up, but the internet was like in the family room and you were only allowed to be on it for X amount of time. And like, I felt zero need to ever be on the computer. And I just remember it was something Britta was talking about with the X-Files and just sort of like getting involved in these weird online communities. And I just vividly remember one time, like accidentally stumbling upon this isn't even bad, guys, but I thought I had found the coolest thing in the internet that no one else knew about. And it was, okay, so my first like true fandom where like I was buying anything that I could get my hands on and downloading and printing out photos of every single thing. Like it couldn't have even involved fan fiction was Will and Grace. And it still is. Like I'm still that person.
Yeah.
But I found like the NBC.com Will and Grace page. And they had this section on there that was like, granted, this is like when I am in like eighth grade, freshman year of high school. Like this isn't, I was not a cool child. So they had like this section where it was like clearly sponsored by whoever designed for Will and Grace, like the set designers, because it was like, you can buy like, you know, like the glassware that Will has and like, like label what it was.
Well, that one painting on his wall.
Yeah.
That I love.
So they had like really awesome, like close up pictures of like the set that you wouldn't get to see that angle on camera because it's like a three camera sitcom. Like the cameras aren't going into the apartment. I was obsessed with it. I was on there. I was like mapping out the apartment, like with new dimensions. And I'm like, okay, so the glasses would be arranged like this and like looking at bowls and stuff. Like I was all over it, like down to like Will's bedroom setup. Like I had everything like mapped out to a T of what this apartment was like. And it was just, I would like get nervous. I'm like, oh my God, they're going to look at my browser history and just see I spent like hours and hours on this. And I'm like, this was not bad. It just like, so anything fandom interviews or like, you know, just people talking about like, yeah, I would spend hours like reading fan fiction and like getting involved and talking to random people on the internet. Like I wasn't allowed to have Facebook until I got Facebook senior year of high school and like, but like barely friend requesting people because I'm like, no, I can't have this person have access to anything that I do in my life. Yeah. So a very different experience. I was very much an outsider in that regard. And I just like, I love hearing about it. Like every time someone talks about like how old they were and when they got started, like involved with like writing or talking to other people who liked the same things that they did. Like it always felt weird to me finding something online, even if it was like literally a network's press page. Like I would look at like the Gilmore Girls like, episode stills the week before they came out. And I thought I was doing something like so revolutionary and like being like, okay.
Deep dive nerding.
Yeah, exactly. Like being like, okay, so in the preview that the WB aired that I like taped on a VHS, like it shows that like this scene. Okay, but then these pictures, like that is as far as I was going, but I only like it's fun to realize that like everyone at that age, though, even if they were interacting with the community, still felt isolated in what they were doing by themselves. Like you can't take that back to like homeroom and being like, why are you so tired? We didn't even like have any homework last night. And I'm like, deep into whether or not Luke and Lorelai are going to get together. Like, you know,
so, what you just said about taping on VHS, that's just made me think of a very early fandom like thing for me, which just exchanging. I had a VHS tape like that I taped off the TV was Once More with Feeling, the Buffy episode. Which I was, that was,
I had that single episode downloaded on like Napster or something, but yeah, anyway, carry on.
But I remember I was talking about this, trying to talk about this with people at school, but nobody else cared as much as me. And I found this one girl who was kind of interested in it, that was in the drama club, which I was also in. And she was like, okay, well, I haven't really watched this show, but like, lend me the VHS and I'll watch it. And, you know, I might get into it. So I was like, yes, this is, my time has come. Like, I can recruit somebody and we can talk about Buffy and like how perfect Buffy and Spike are. So I lent her the VHS, which about 2 weeks later, she returned to me and she had taped over it.
Oh, no.
So suffice to say,
why?
We were not friends after that.
Why? How did this happen?
I feel like it was like a reality show had been taped over half of it.
Did she do it to be spiteful, or was it just like, oh, no, not that big a deal?
I think it was like a mistake, and she was like, oops, sorry, this happened. And it was like, you know, friendship over. Like budding friendship over the Buffy.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I love old Buffy stories of like people. I've heard it from like a couple of people, like when the anniversary just happened, like a year ago or something, like people were sharing stories like on Twitter and stuff being like, we used to like trade VHSs at our lockers, like of episodes. And I was like, wow, I forgot like how long ago some shows were, even though it's not that long ago. Technology is just crazy. But like, you know.
Brittany's very new to Buffy because we just did it on our rewatchable podcast, and she was a newbie through our Buffy watch, and that was a time was had. Yeah. So, I remember reading like GeoCities web pages of like Harry Potter theories, like theories of you know, like pre Goblet of Fire, I think, like you know, like of just like stuff that was totally fictionalized, I assume, because it was like ridiculous. But I also remember like discovering a lot of like of fan fiction, and the first would have been like self-insert, like Mary Sue fan fiction, basically, about stuff like the Tamora Pierce books that I loved. And I remember there was a girl at my school who had also read them and liked them. And one day she came over to my house, and I was just like, "Have you seen this?" You know, like, and it's like. And she had not, like, this was, again, very much, like, not some, like, it didn't go badly, but it was just not a connection of, like, of why would you want this or do this, and very odd. But anyway, we can, but, yeah, what was it about that Britta was saying that kind of just that experience of, like, how it used to be for people who found themselves with these impulses of needing to roll around in this world that they've found, and how that was not normal. And now the kids go to school and they talk about it at school. It's very strange.
I envy today's teenagers for having that as a thing that they can do. And even just the accessibility, I guess, of these fandom communities, which, I mean, I guess they did exist when back when I was a teenager as well, but I guess it just wasn't something I was aware of. I wish I had been aware of it.
Yeah, and I think that's what it really made me think of too, was the fact that with Harry Potter, for me, I never had any clue of what was going on the internet with Harry Potter, mainly because I had real friends, like, not real friends. I have a lot of online
meet space
like,
friends.
Yeah, exactly. Like people who sat next to me physically who also liked Harry Potter and wanted to talk about it in person. So like I didn't feel a need to go there. but not every 13-year-old girl starting high school is obsessed with Will and Grace. So I found a way around that, and not everyone was watching Gilmore Girls. So I found a place to go and search it out. Whereas like now every kid, like who, like when I was that age, like they have it in the palm of their hand. Like they don't even need to ever talk to the person who's sitting literally next to them. They can live in a world where people only want to talk about what they want to talk about, and they can find it very easily.
Yeah.
With Will and Grace, because it's not, it's interesting. It's actually the other way around. Like it's actually the other, because if we're talking about like, you know, something that was like 15 years ago or so, it's also, you see, you know, you're saying you're an eighth grade, like girl, like obsessed with Will and Grace. Like how common was it in your schooling environment and stuff like that to be like that involved with like normalizing like a gay culture thing, as opposed to like, because Britta's talking about like people who are making, you know, fictional or reading a queer reading of like a straight show. Will and Grace is like a little bit different in that you might have only, you know, might have only been thinking about the canon, but it was like a gay sitcom in the time when you're like a young teen, and it was not that common at the time.
Right. So I think the thing that I clung to with that show, because it was very normalized to me in a sense, but just because I loved the show and like the characters were the characters, were Will and Grace's, the platonic nature of Will and Grace's friendship was what I wanted to watch for. Like I could, everyone around me was watching Friends because Friends and Will and Grace were in the same comedy block.
And
so it was, everyone was watching Friends for the will they, won't they, and talking about every single pairing that could happen between those six people. And that did nothing for me. I watched it because it was the lead in to Will and Grace, but that like, it was, I just was watching it to watch it. I had zero commentary about it. I didn't care if Ross and Rachel ended up together. I wasn't obsessed with it. It didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was like, are Will and Grace going to go to a coffee shop today? Like, what are they doing and how are they supporting each other? And I was so obsessed with that friendship that I wasn't like projecting anything on the characters. They were just doing it for me. But I was also thinking at the same time, like, what is this? What about this dynamic makes it work? And so like, it was more of like deconstructing their relationship in like, not a, what I want to happen, but how does it happen type of way. And then with like watching Friends or something, you know, it's like Ross and Rachel, like what makes them good for each other? Oh, well she said this. Oh, he looked at her when she was pouring coffee. Like there's that element to it as well. But like I just participated in those things. So I kept getting invited to Sweet 16. So like, it wasn't like, I was like, yeah, oh totally. God. Whatever.
Interesting. It's interesting. Like that it makes you like think like more analytically. And it's interesting because Cass, it reminds me of what I said, what I said to you about needing to go see John Cameron Mitchell, about what he said in that. We just had a tour in Australia of John Cameron Mitchell doing a Hedwig tribute, not a tribute, but like a retrospective, of, you know, obviously. And he was talking, how did he say it? He was saying like that, you know, gay people or, you know, people, you know, involved in gay culture, and this is not exactly the same as your experience, Brittany, but it does sort of reflect on fandom. And he was saying like that they were the first, well, like they're always like the best analysts.
They're clicked into meta analysis, like, and looking at things from more than one level, basically, like looking deeper because we've always had to.
Because because it's like deconstructing like things, and it's interesting that like with fandom and with, you know, like Tess's experience in the book and Claire's experience in the book fandom, and it sort of reflects on something he said about, you know, like with gay culture, they're always, because of the hidden aspects of it, there was always like another layer to analyze. So it, people that are interested in like gay culture and media, you know, or people who are queer get invested in media in a deeper perspective and a more deconstructive perspective because they're used to looking below the surface at all things. And yeah. So it's interesting how that tied into fandom and for a lot of people, and how a lot of, oh, like what happens in this book, like, you know, and what happens in fandom is, you know, the reading of layers of media and the deeper investment is, there is a parallel there for that aspect as well. And it's interesting because Brittany is such a conscious thinker at all times. Like, she's always got something to deconstruct, and perhaps this came from her. Like, the fact that you were drawn to something like Will and Grace and that you're pulling it apart in that way as opposed to other things is very interesting to me. Yeah. Anyway, we should get on with the actual book. So we Ship It by Britta London. Is a novel about, you know, about fandom and fan fiction and queer readings of television show and queer baiting, and what is a big and a huge part of the media experience for a lot of people these days, and how it's developing but still kind of underground and all that kind of stuff. So you should go and read the book, definitely. We're gonna talk pretty frankly about it, I guess, on the show. So there will be spoilers if you haven't read it. And it's a great book, and it's really just a shockingly poignant book. So we're gonna talk about it, and we've got some gripes and hypes. We've got our obsessions to share and our grievances to air about Ship It and the things that Ship It made us feel. So we're gonna start with gripes, and you know, none of them are really a reflection of the book being bad in any way, because we all loved the book. So it's interesting. Brittany, we'll start with you, because I'm interested in this because I don't know how much you know about the truth behind this subject and what it was based on in this book. Mm. Because Cass and I know very, very well. Brittany is
very entrenched.
Very new to the supernatural experience, mainly via osmosis to me. And there is a lot of what I'm very interested to see what you have to say here, because you may be shocked to learn some of the truth about this situation.
Okay, so the thing I picked apart here, which I'm sure you guys can expand upon, is audience Q&As. Okay. I don't like audience Q&As as a general blanket statement. I am very uncomfortable. I don't like, if I could, without being rude, I would leave every single panel I've ever sat in to leave an audience Q&A. I fast forward them in recorded sessions. I will probably, mostly what I'll do if I'm watching a video and there's an audience Q&A is I will mute the person asking the question and only watch the response and get it from context clues.
Oh my God.
I get very, very bad secondhand embarrassment to the point where it's like a crippling feeling in my stomach that I have to get away from. So this book wasn't even the worst offender that I've read, because after I finished Ship It, I read it on a plane in like one sitting and I just wanted to get home, and I reread. Well, I read them backwards. I read Carry On into Fangirl again, just to like read something that I knew was semi-related and I had physically on hand. Mm. But then I read another book that I downloaded from Amazon because I was like, I want to read something else that's in this realm of fandom and stuff. And it was, the whole point of the book was these two guys, it's called How to Dismantle a Mechanical Heart. And these two guys have a, like a vlog together about a show, a supernatural, you know, whatever type show. And they travel to like the five, again, sort of like Ship It. They travel to a couple of stops along the tour, and the purpose of the book is them at every single Q&A. And they know, like the whole community knows that they're going to do this, is they're going to ask about a couple from the show, like they're asking the same question about the same couple at every.
I've never heard of this book.
No, it's called How to Repair a Mechanical Heart. I will look up the author
and
give you a link. But it's on my phone actually, because I downloaded it from my Kindle app. But anyway, so like I read that book two books after reading this, and this is all within the span of like 5 days. Like I really dove into all this, and I just kept thinking about the Ship It Q&A portions and the How to Repair Mechanical Heart Q&A like scenes, and just I get what people in the audience want and what types of responses they want to get. I don't think audience Q&As are the place where you're going to get answers, if you're going to get answers at all. And so I'm not a fan of them, as I said, in general, and reading about them was almost worse than watching and listening to them. Cause like, I just know what's coming and I could feel for the people on the stage and also the PR people and also the people who are in the audience who like are in the position that I am, know what the answer is going to be, and like feel bad for the person asking, but also like, come on, why are you wasting our time here type of deal. So I don't know. Like I said, it's a gripe about something bigger than what the book is about, but it was just something that stuck out to me again. Like I don't know what people want with audience Q&As, and
it's it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about Supernatural fandom. Supernatural runs a convention tour with about 12 to 14 stops a year, possibly more. So it took one weekend a month, sometimes two weekends a month. The entire current cast, plus a variety of fan favorite former cast members, appear at conventions that are not a promotional event. They're not a San Diego Comic-Con where they are appearing to talk about the season. They are there strictly for a fan meeting. And so every panel is only audience Q&A, as in they, you know, Misha's up there for an hour taking questions from the audience, and Jared and Jensen are up there for an hour taking questions from the audience. And this is once or twice a month all year. And it is how the majority of tidbits and information and perspective of the cast members get out there into the world. They have more FaceTime with the fandom than most, if not any, other current properties. And the amount of aggression or misreading or weaponization of this platform or this procedure is a weekly to monthly volcanic explosion of drama. Because, you know, someone will say, oh, they said this in the Q&A, and then like a week later a full video of context will come out and it's like, didn't mean that at all and stuff like that. Or like, yeah, people will ask a question to be confrontational or fishing for an answer and stuff like that.
Very leading questions
Very clearly month, leading. Every fortnight, all year, all the time. And a lot of the drama in Ship It was developed from some large controversies that have come out of that situation with Supernatural, basically, because obviously, you know, San Diego Comic-Con and those big like public Comic-Cons where there is a hosted panel is a different circumstance. And yes, sometimes those Q&As are also very tiresome. But the Supernatural convention tour is all like that. It's not a panel where there's an angle that, you know, someone is leading. It is all like that.
It's not a curated questions.
You know, it's not a themed panel, like, you know, like about, you know, talking about a topic. It is, here we are. It's the fans ask us questions.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, it is exhausting. It is sometimes nice, but mostly exhausting. Because either people will ask something that's been asked a million times before that, you know, half the audience will groan at because they know it's been asked a million times before, but that person is just a random lady who lives in Cleveland who thought she'd have a nice day out at the Supernatural show and doesn't know it's been asked before, you know, like, and then some of it is like weaponized behavior. And it is just sickening, but the big climax of what happened in this in Ship It, with like them being asked about shipping and then it being banned, like that, like the Forest trying to ban, you know, that kind of topic, is a kind of an interpretation of some pretty bad drama that happened with Supernatural and queer baiting in like about season 8 or 9 of the show.
Yeah, around season 8, I think.
Yeah.
Late season 8, early season 9.
Yeah, and there's quite a few incidents in the book which are specifically referencing that event, not just a theory. It is the DNA of Ship It is very much tied to what happened in Supernatural about 5 years ago, which Britta was in the fandom for. So, yes, it is horrible. Q&As are horrible. Cass and I were recently at a Supernatural convention in Rome where people with a very bad attitude tried to flood, like stack the line at said Q&As in order to exclude certain people from questions, like exclude certain actors or ask pointed questions. And so then like people who did not really, you know, have any interest in asking questions but who didn't want these people to be douchebags were like, oh, maybe we should get up and ask a question to block them out from stopping to do that. And like that, like it's fucked up. It is really gross. And so if you think you've seen it bad, you ain't seen nothing till you've been to a Supernatural convention. And it is just horrific. So and sorry. This year at San Diego Comic Con, there was only 2 fan questions. They ran the panel very long with the curated part and only had time for 2 fan questions. What a shame. So yeah, it's pretty rough and certainly stressful in the book and in person. Mm. But oh, is it true to life? So I guess it's a good interpretation of that. Have you had any particularly bad ones, Brittany, that you've had to sit through or like just wanted to die in?
Oh, no, this is like every single one. So it's always like someone who gets up to the mic and they're like, I just want to say, and then they like give a life story and there's no question. And like, I get that. But not the time and space when you have 250 people packed into a room and people want something else.
The real question.
Yeah. I will say, like, this only happens really, like, when I – okay, so when I went to the Gilmore Girls reunion at ATX a few years ago, this happened a lot. And I was dreading the audience Q&A from, like – I was on the red carpet asking questions like to the whole cast, to a cast that, like I said earlier in this episode, I was stalking production stills of online. Like, I will say I had my moments, like when Milo Ventimiglia got out of the van behind me and I let out like a high-pitched squeak as he was coming around to like walk, get onto the red carpet line. That happened. Like, I really freaked out when I met you know, all the boys, the three men of Rory's life who were standing together, including Supernatural's own real Dean. you know, he was there in all his beautiful glory.
Yeah, the photo of you and him is very sweet.
I'm very professional, though. I'm again.
Yeah, it's not a posed photo. It's like someone else's photo of the interview, and it's very sweet.
But that was not always. That was my professionalism taking over my internal.
And it's totally different. Like I was freaking shaking when I met Hugh Dancy at the end of the Hannibal press conference. Mm-hmm. Press conference was fine. I was asking questions. They were responding back and forth, including Hugh. And when I went up to Hugh in person, I was like shaking. Like I was like the photo is blurry because I was trembling and babbling. So it is fine, but yes, people definitely, there's an attitude of that they want something for them. They're thinking about themselves rather than actually caring about the information that they're asking for, which is, you know, what, you know, I guess some people feel like they have the right to that. Neil Gaiman has an interesting, like, whenever he does an audience Q&A, he kind of makes a very, like, passive aggressively pointed but polite, like he's like, just so you remember, a question is a, you know, a short sentence aimed to gather information that goes up at the end, like like he kind of puts in a little point to before he starts to like prevent people just doing storytelling and you yeah. know, like, or doing something, you know, weird and like a lot of people like challenging questions, like they like look like an asshole, and it's just like that's very confusing. But you know, in this book, it's obviously not the right vehicle to ask about that shipping question. And mm-hmm. and what I find interesting mm-hmm. is, like, you know, was Claire that naive? Like, did she legitimately yeah. think it was reasonable, or was she, because she was obviously very isolated in her experience, but she was so popular on Tumblr that surely she would know, like, the lay of the land. But I guess it's a yeah. first season show. The people haven't really done conventions before. Yeah. So there's a lot of context about, like, why she did that. But yeah. obviously one of the things that I talked about in Britta with the interview is, like, Claire's not meant to look great the whole book. Like, she does some really terrible things as a fan that you would never want a fan to do. And the point is that she has to grow from that. And, you know, so yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely, a lot of it is her sort of learning about boundaries, which is very important, I think, for people in fandom. And definitely something that I think a lot, Brittany, a lot of the cringe factor that comes from Q&A is people not knowing what a boundary is and how to yeah. respect that. And almost treating the actors that they see on stage as almost as fictional as the characters, as if they're just sort of there for entertainment and not people.
Like, that they have to do what they are, yeah. like, you yeah. know, like a performing monkey.
Yeah, yeah. like dance. Like,
yeah, you're on stage to give me what I want.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. It's a kind of, you know, because these people, obviously as fans, we love the show or we love the book or whatever it is, the media that we're enjoying, we love it and we love the people that are on it or that are the characters that are in it. But there is a point of putting people and actors on pedestals where it becomes like they cease being.
It's
people.
Dehumanizing.
Yeah, yeah, it's that's a dehumanizing, like, kind of pedestal. Like,
yeah.
Which is evident, I think, in a lot of the way people can approach those audience Q&As, which for me, I agree, the cringe factor can be agonizing.
Oh, for that it's so bad sometimes. And, oh, yeah, it is terrible. I did love the climax of Ship It at the San Diego Comic-Con event. Obviously, it all goes very badly until then, but that's also like a total, like, rose-colored glasses, delightful panel yeah. experience. But it is yeah, often very stressful.
Yeah, and like I said, yeah. this was not necessarily a gripe about the book, but it made me yeah. think of larger gripes in general and how...
Yeah, of course.
They just present themselves, like how Q&As just are a thing and almost are a necessary evil that we have to deal with, but at the same yeah. time, like, need to be completely revolutionized, but probably never will be. Because yeah. like you yeah. said, there's always the one random woman from Cleveland who will ask the question that the whole room already knows, and there's always yeah. someone with an agenda.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because with the supernatural conventions, my big thing is, I'm like, why don't you curate this more? Like, why don't you make it, like, instead of a performance of, like, here's this actor, why don't you, like, set a topic? Like, here's three people who have all portrayed Lucifer. Like, let's talk about that arc yeah. and how you did that and what you took from each other. You know, like, let's talk about, like, the topics. Like, let's talk about, you yeah. know, like mix and match the different actors to talk about a topic. Yeah. And of course people can ask questions, but like
within that
intellectual discussion, because they're all very smart and they all make a good show of answering things either even answered before. Like it's always a great environment from the actors with Supernatural, but it could be a lot richer for certain ideas. But anyway, yeah, it's just interesting that you mentioned that part of the book, Brittany, because it is a lot of the controversy that the book covers, which obviously stems from that, is a mirror of what happened in real life with Supernatural and queer baiting and stuff like that from that kind of public confrontation and all sorts of things. So it's a fun thing that to live through, but yeah. Okay. All right. We'll move on to Cass. So Cass, do you want to sort of lead a bit of a discussion about your gripe with the Shipit experience or what it made you think of?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is barely even a gripe because like I adore this book, but for me, the showrunner, Jamie, was almost too much of a jerk, which,
yeah.
I mean, I know there's definitely showrunners like Jamie out there that are running various programs, but the whole time when he was kind of getting cooler about the situation, I was kind of thinking, like, come on, you're better than this, even though obviously he wasn't. But I'm so used to assuming the best intentions of the powers that be of whatever show I'm watching. Because I have to do that. I can't enjoy something if I don't trust the people making it. And so that was hard for me for just to, it was kind of confronting to think about something that I try not to think about with some shows. I guess there probably are jerk people at the top. So yeah, sort of thinking about that was confronting in a way that bothered me. But like I said, it's not so much a gripe about the book as it is it's a personal, that was my personal reaction to it, like feeling like forcing me to confront that within my own consumption, I guess, of shows.
I mean, no, it's interesting because, you know, that the one quote that he did give to Claire about the context of TV, like, and the networks, and like, you know, he gave her a big speech about it. And it still had a bit of a mean twist to it, but it did have a lot of honest reality check about television production. There's a lot in this book about television production that is like very real. And like Britta said, it's like if fans who have like certain ideas about how like TV works and story works, take a bit of time to like listen to like, TV writer podcasts and stuff like that, they'd understand
understand
with a bit more different approach to how they react to certain things, like the intention of something, and
you know, why things have to happen in certain ways, and
and it doesn't even mean, you know, and I'm talking about, you know, even as basic as like, you know, the morons who act like television is like written and filmed week to week, like, you know, like as it's airing, like they can change it before the next week or something.
Before next week.
And, you know, but on a deeper level, I'm with you in that I always am approaching how something, you know, why something's done from a behind the scenes perspective, like as in, I'm very much with you on that. I'm sure there are people like Jamie or worse, you know, but I also think he is a bit of a cartoon villain in this, intentionally, again, like to make it look really bad. I don't know. It's, you know, and then there's the other showrunner of the sci-fi show that, you know, happens at the end, who has a much more, you know, cool, like, you know, it's interesting to see Jamie act like that guy is a douche until we sort of meet him from Claire's perspective and then find out that he's actually like a really cool, legit guy. And so, I don't know, I'm sure there are terrible showrunners out there. Mm. I haven't met any, I hope, but.
Well, you haven't met Ryan Murphy, right?
I haven't met Ryan Murphy. I have never heard.
I feel like Jamie is my Ryan Murphy. The problem is I enjoy so much of what he does, but I cannot stand him when he makes certain decisions. But then again, that's that give and take of like, am I blaming Ryan Murphy? I put a lot on Ryan Murphy because I feel like he owns it so well. That like it's easy to be mad at him when it could have been like a random writer who like wrote something. Like, I'm not even talking about Glee. I'm talking about the cluster fuck that is American Horror Story.
So
like I project so much on him. So like I really to like just having that scapegoat being that you're just gonna sit in a bus and like angrily stare at the back of their head. Trapped on a bus tour with Ryan Murphy, I wouldn't even get anything. I'd just sit there with my arms crossed, glaring the whole time.
It's interesting. I have no idea. He's so strange. I haven't heard many people say many good things about him, except the actors that he like keeps on a like
exactly
lock and chain.
Like Sarah Paulson, who's been in every project he's done for the last 10 years.
Even with Darren Criss doing American Horror Story, Darren kept saying like, oh yeah, like when I worked on Glee, like I never really worked with him. Like maybe one episode he directed or something. And I'm like, where was he? He was on the lot the whole time. Like yeah, he wrote most of those episodes. Where was he? Like, but Darren, you know, in this American Horror Story tour, he said like for the whole run of Glee that he always was felt or was made to feel like the new kid, even though he came in season 2 out of 7, you know, 6 seasons. And so that was really interesting. But, you know, and Ryan now, and yeah, I think I was watching the thing he did with Mandy Moore, the like the conversation about their various positions or something like that. And he was talking about like, yeah, how he got American Crime Story, and that like, you know, he'd gone down to like set or something in New Orleans for like Horror Story or for the other one, it wasn't O.J. Simpson. It was one of them. I don't remember. Mm. And he was like, oh yeah. Like, and I was invited down, and then I got like my 15 minutes with Ryan, which was like a really big deal. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure you're not meant to like say this about it made Ryan look so bad in this interview. And I'm like, I don't know if that was his intention, but it made him look like a total egomaniac. And so maybe it is all his control. But we had that with Buffy as well. We had a lot of questioning of like the writer's agendas and Joss Whedon's agendas as we rewatched Buffy, and we like saw a lot of the stuff that was like problematic, like Xander's attitude towards like women. Anyone? And stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and stuff like that. So I don't know. It is interesting. Like, I am 100% sure that, you know, any horror story that's in a fictional book about Hollywood is a million times worse in real life. Yeah. I wouldn't like to think that it was anyone that I thought was decent. But I don't know. You know, I'm sure that people are way grosser and like way more blatant about being terrible. But Jamie it is nasty. So luckily I do try to align myself. I do try to align myself with shows that start with a good behind the scenes environment, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Like it's one of the things that
got a good reputation. Yeah.
Like what the show is actually about is very low on my priority list of like how I get interested in it these days. I get interested because of like cast and crew atmosphere, like
how decent are these people.
It's the same as One Direction. I started liking One Direction not because I objectively was like good music. I was like, oh, these are nice boys. Yeah. I'm going to enjoy their things like a macaroni art that my children made. You know, I do like a lot of One Direction's music and stuff, but it's a different order.
I would love to see some macaroni art created specifically by Harry Styles. Like, I feel like maybe that could be his next album. The cover art should be some macaroni.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of goes back to like what Britta was talking about, where you guys started getting into like, one of the better moments, like where you do kind of find yourself almost completely in Jamie's corner, is when he's giving that speech about, like, you don't know what's going into this fully.
Yeah.
You never will. Like, you don't know that there's millions and millions of dollars and a budget to stick to. And the fact that, look, it was, and like, even Rico has this conversation, like when they were talking about like, what do you remember from that scene? And it's just like that it was cold and it was the final take and it was late at night. Like, it's just, we had to get this scene done. Like, you could think that they planned it and they really went into it and they were getting it. But like, it's just sometimes a shot is taken and it works beautifully on so many levels that it might not have even been caught on filming by the director in the editing bay or anywhere else until it hits your screen. Something could pass that has so much meaning that no one else has paid attention to. They just know they got the take they needed with the right lighting under budget.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there are scenes where they are actively trying to get the shot that means what it's supposed to mean, but like sometimes they do really just happen. And like, I know as a fan of stuff, I find that really hard to believe. Like, that this one gif of something that all, it could like, be from anything.
Surely it has to be intentional.
You know, you catch yourself being like, no, you know the reality of the situation, but at the same time, you're like, but is it? I don't know.
Like trying to force off the shipping goggles or just the fan theory goggles can be difficult for that reason. But knowing the production reasons for why things have had to happen in a certain way or why things have turned out the way they have, it's definitely an important thing to be aware of, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think it gives you a much better...
more grounded
gauge. Like, it stops you wasting your energy in unnecessary outrage. Not saying that you can't, like, super want something or even believe it, but it puts a little bit of a bent of reality onto it, like, if you know what I mean. Like, it puts a little bit of a, you kind of know from your own perspective that, like, okay, even though I am being as realistic as I have the education to be about this, I still feel like that is real or still feel like that works. Mm. You know, that can also be, like, a more grounded sign of, like, you know, believing in a ship or not believing in a ship or, you know, like whatever. So,
I think it also works too, or should work in a perfect world, not even to like break yourself out of anything. You do whatever you want to do on Tumblr, reblog a gif of a scene as many times as you want, unpack it, obsess over it, do talk to other people about it. But I think it acts as that fail safe that should kick in when you're in a Q&A line and you want to have that filter just come on and be like, this was probably filmed at 3 a.m. something. Yeah. Unless you're like asking a writer or something, being like, when you were crafting, like leading into this scene, what were the like intent? Like, I feel like there's
different
ways and different people to ask the questions of what you're trying to unpack, and not the actor who probably really doesn't remember filming that scene.
That's exactly a big thing as well. Like, the intent of the narrative, people like put it on the actors so much, especially with Supernatural, that I'm like, okay, like you're in recent, like, I've had that conversation with like writers and directors of Supernatural in interviews and stuff like that, like, you know, of what was intended, you know, what was the mindset behind it. And then the actors, you know, and I've also seen the actors like say like the total opposite or like miss the point of like what was the narrative intention or something like that. So it's, you know, you do have a big production of hundreds of people who are maybe not all on the same page about it, you know, like a set, you know, an actor could be wearing a costume that a costume designer thinks about like metaphorical implications of, and the actor would have no idea, you know, like that, you know, like that kind of thing.
Oh, this is just the shirt they gave me that day. Like,
That was the shirt they gave me. And the costume designer was like, oh, you know, this shirt, you know, worn open in this way is like a sign that like he's lost control of his life or like, you know, like something, they talk about that. They talk about that in the book, in Ship It, with the Smokey's jacket, like being the panel being ripped off and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's really, there's so many layers of interpretation. Some of them may be true. Some of them may not be true.
Yeah.
What it is, what's the most important is that what's true for even people working behind the scenes might not all be on the same page as each other. It might be a writer putting in something intentionally that they know a network executive will never allow to be developed, but they're putting it in intentionally because they want it. If you know what I mean, they're doing, or something like that, you know, or it might be, you know, something completely the opposite of that. So I agree with Britta saying, like, anyone who's like getting very passionate in fandom, educate yourself on television production. Like, it's the best balance you can possibly have. I have seen some
unbelievably confident theories about television, like shows that are, they would pass beautifully if you were writing an academic essay about an interpretation of a narrative, like about a book that's, you know, the author's been dead for 100 years. But that's not how current television production works.
Yeah.
So you cannot like make these confident academic theories about the meaning of something without taking a dose of realism of production.
Yeah.
And so some of this,
knowing the full perspective.
Yeah. Some of this massive confidence that people have about theories, and I don't just mean about shipping at all. I mean about everything.
Mm. Yeah.
Is the kind of academic thinking that you could think you could pass theoretically in a university degree, but it doesn't actually fly when there is television production reasoning behind it.
Yeah.
I do have one caveat to that, and that is when Mad Men was on, Tom and Lorenzo, who are like fashion bloggers by trade. I know. I'm just introducing them for the podcast. I brought them to my college. I'm obsessed with them. So they did Mad Style every week after the episode would air on Sunday. Mad Style would come out on Wednesday. It was my favorite day of the week. So they, thousands and thousands of words are poured over the fashion of Mad Men and what Betty is wearing and what mood and like what, you know, what Don's suits are about. But they would get Lou, the fashion designer who now works with Ryan Murphy exclusively because Ryan Murphy has known everyone. Like, she would talk to them and sometimes, and they're aware of this. They're like, you know, that dress was the only thing that they could get from this time period and make in the costume shop. She's like, that's just what it was. That's what we decided to go with that day. Or one of the characters, like one of the actresses was pregnant. So like we only chose her to put her in this because we had to hide her pregnancy. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just, it, some of it is it works and it doesn't work.
Yeah,
but
it's just
then
practicality
that,
sometimes.
Exactly. But that picking apart did ultimately play into these big, larger themes that were going on in the show. And it allowed them a gateway to talk about the larger themes that are going on in the show, whether or not the clothes were a direct relation to it. That other stuff was happening, but the clothes were their gateway. So I think it's like also smart to differentiate like what you're using as a gateway is not necessarily meaningful to anyone else, but the stuff you're getting at is meaningful to a bunch of people.
And if everyone's doing their job well, it should all add together, you know, if everyone's doing their job well, it should all,
There should be a tie
help that theme, you know, but it doesn't mean that the individuals are, sometimes the actors are the last to know about that kind of thing. As
right.
Well.
So like
the, you know, like,
if like Claire is reading into the fact that Hart's jacket is telling her this story, that could be the story that the writer is trying to tell, and she found a way into it through a jacket.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
She got there.
Yeah. Like Hannibal had a lot of that with both the clothing design and the food design.
That was like very specifically done.
Yeah. That was intentional on every level. Yeah. That was an aim of the show. But yeah, it's, anyway, the point is television production reasons are important and not always as sinister as you think. But I'm sure that Jamie, there are worse monsters than
Jamie. There are probably
Jamies
out there.
Yeah. Mm. So I'm going to go into my gripe, which is the insecurity that this book made me feel when reading it. I found this book incredibly anxiety inducing to read. And I don't just mean like secondhand embarrassment of the story. I meant that it's a flip side of what we're going to go into with Cass's gripe. So I'll get her to start with that straight off the back of this. But it is the best, most honest, true portrayal of what I feel like it feels like to feel these things about a fandom and about like a queer reading and all of that kind of stuff. It felt like a very accurate portrayal in many, many ways of the fandom experience of people who do gravitate towards this. And the fact that it felt so real and true made me feel very stressed, and like that I didn't want people to read it, like that I didn't want like civilians to pick it up on a bookshelf in a store and read it and either see that it was true or assume that it wasn't, the same way I'd read something about sports and not know how accurate it was, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Like I did, like it made me feel very insecure. And I think I wrote in my review of it that like for Hyperbole, because I reviewed it, that it made me feel like I was like standing naked in the middle of Times Square. Yeah. And so that was very interesting. Like, and I'm like, why do I want, like, why does this make me upset? Like, am I ashamed? Like, is it, what is it that's making me feel scared and upset of people reading this and knowing it's true? And so that was kind of an interesting personal development that I haven't really understood yet. It is what it is. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't give it to my dad and be like, this is how I feel about life. In a slightly more educated way than a 16-year-old girl. But, you know, I definitely do think that everyone should read it. I think it would do a very big favour to a lot of actors and TV crew. Like if people work on a show that has a fandom, I think that it's a very good like resource for those people who are there like, we don't really get like how else, like what these fans are all about. And this is kind of like a textbook for that. I know a couple of TV, Britta obviously is a TV writer on Riverdale and she came from fandom, and I know a few other TV writers and stuff who've read it. I would love every actor on Supernatural and, you know, like Teen Wolf and Captain America. Like I would love everyone to read it. But for some reason, yeah, it also just makes me feel really anxious. And I don't know why. And I'm like, is this like, is it a shame thing or is it like embarrassment? Like it's or just vulnerability. So it made me feel really horrified, though the ending, you know, it made me feel so happy at the end. Even though the end game of the book is not like the answer that Claire wanted, which is very much what Britta talked about as well with her, like changing it from being like more rosy colored.
Yeah.
It did really feel like an important understanding, you know, at the end and everything. And I would recommend it to everyone that I want to understand me. Maybe that's why it's scary. Maybe I don't want people to understand
the horror of being known.
Yeah, kind of. And so that's my big gripe. It just made me feel like very exposed. And so that's probably a signature of its, you know, grip on reality. But yeah, that was my main gripe with Ship It. So I don't know. Did you feel that way at all, Brittany, or did you feel a bit more detached from it?
Well, I think it kind of goes into my hype actually. So like I'm in a very middle ground with this book where like I just find television production and writing and the bells and whistles and everything that makes a show come together fascinating, and I always have. Because I think the gateway into that again was Will and Grace, because you pull back and like you see directly behind the camera and you're like, you know that there's no fourth wall there. Whereas like other like shows like dramas and stuff, like you feel like you're very much in the room, but like you have that attachment going into a sitcom. So
a sitcom's more like watching theater.
Exactly.
It's more like, yeah.
So I love I've always loved knowing who's writing what, who's doing, like I loved all of that aspect of it. I am not an active fan on anything besides Twitter. And even there, I'm like, I tweet once and then I like shut off my computer because I don't want to be too involved. So it was very like, I was detached from that part of the book, but I'm also vaguely aware. So I'm the, like, this is getting into my hype. I'm like the Rico of the situation. Like, I know what's going on over here with production and what they're telling me I need to say, but I also know what's going to make fans feel uncomfortable, what they're looking for, and I'm totally cool with it. If that's what you are passionate about and you want to spend your time doing, I am more than happy to look at your fan art, read your fan fiction, do all of this, but I am not personally going to do it. So like, I'm not act like Natalie was kind of saying, our first meeting ever was at a coffee shop that was featured in a fanfic. I've read maybe a total of 5 fanfics my entire life. And that happened to be one of them.
Yeah. But your friend was much more involved.
Yeah. And because I was like dipping my toes in Glee, but it was a scary, like the show I was completely immersed in and loved it. But the fan community is terrifying. And so like, I finally, like Glee was just the show that came up next at the time where I was like in college, had my computer, was like, you know, by myself. I was the clearly the only person in my entire campus watching the show besides like my roommate who I really think only watched it to appease me. And, you know, like you have to keep everything else that you're feeling about the show kind of bottled up and being like, yeah, that episode was fine. I'm not going to go rewatch it 10 times right now. Like, you know, like that's just not,
I'm going to watch it a normal amount of time.
Yeah. I mean, like, oh wait, I don't remember what happened last week to you. Like you don't yet the choreography to Teenage Dream. No, you don't want to do it now. Okay. That's fine. So like, you know, there's just like, you know, there's a different connection there. So like I wasn't getting that with like the person I was actively watching Glee with every week. And it got to a point where Glee started my sophomore year of college. By senior year of college, we still lived together, me and my roommate, and she was like, I know you need to watch it alone first, so that's fine. We can watch it later. And like, she just got it. And so I would be like, no, listen, like, you really can't talk to me when it's on. Like, I just, I was like comfortable enough to say that in front of like certain friends, being like, no, I'm going to watch the show and you have to understand what that means to me. I'm watching the show and I cannot be bothered. So like they get that now with like shows, like they're just like, oh, okay, it's one of those shows. But like, you know, I'm not sitting there talking about like, okay, so I was on Tumblr and this person thinks that like, you know, and so I'm a very passive, passive fan in terms of the internet side of things.
Yeah.
I will take a lot in. I don't really put a lot out. Like I'll make a gift set every now and then.
You write.
And I write. Yeah, exactly. But I write
great fan fiction about, you know, Vacation Tenzin. You know, that's
exactly.
Yeah.
But like that was, but that again is like prompted by this almost like professional mode kicking
in.
You know, like that was for the podcast, which services a fan community. So like writing for Hypeable and writing about things I want to see and stuff still has that. Like, yes, I am a fan and I am personally attached to everything I'm writing about, but it does have that bit of an objective, like I need that in order to prompt me to do something. Like I cannot sit down. Okay. Spec scripts aside for like when I was like actively trying to get into writing programs and now I feel like they're not worth it. So like those aside, that's like as close to fan fiction as I've ever gotten. And those were elementary skips. So I was like plotting murders. So like, it wasn't actually like writing wish fulfillment of what I wanted Sherlock and Joan to talk about that night. It was like, now how would they get away with this sort of deal?
Yeah.
It's interesting because I auditioned for Glee Chat on the prompting of someone else who like knew Hyperbole. Because I was like, oh my God, the Glee fandom is so awful, but I want to talk about the show to the extent that I want to talk about the show. So and then someone like offered me this thing to try and I'm like, oh good, I can talk about it in like a crazy way but like in a bubble where I don't have to like read other people's comments, basically. Although there were a lot of terrible comments on Glee Chat too. But yeah, so that's how I got into Hyperbole as well, about that like stepping away from like the trenches of fandom, because it was horrible. So most of my fan engagement has gone through Hyperbole since then with any fandom that I'm in. I'm not like out there and, you know, keyboard warrioring in the comments aside from on Twitter. But the caveat to that is I do read fan fiction, like a lot of fan fiction about the different fandoms that I like. And it comes from a need of wanting more time and more story in the world that I want. Like it's not really driven in like, it's not even like really driven with like discontent of the canon, because a lot of the things that I like, I do love the canon, and it's not like an angry like fuck you, I want this to happen in fan fiction. It's just that I want more time or like more furtherness in the, story.
deeper backstory here, or give me more of what happened in this scene that we didn't get to see.
So I've always read fan fiction, and I've always and maybe it is being queer, like I've always had queer readings of different things, but only when it's been organic. Like there's parts of Ship It that I did not relate to, because it's like, oh, I'm looking for something new to ship or something like that. That's never been me ever. And there are people who do that. They like get into stuff because they want more shipping, or they want fan fiction or something. I am sort of the opposite. I kind of only really ship stuff passionately when I read it naturally.
When you felt it when you're reading it, or when you're
as opposed to like, or like people, I've seen people come into fandoms by reading the fan fiction first, or something like that. They are literally just looking for ship fodder, which is fine, but not my perspective at all.
I mean, and I get comments on fic from people saying, oh, I've never watched the show, but I really enjoyed it. I'm like, thank you, but why are you here?
Yeah, like you're not gonna get like on the deeper like it, like all of the work that you're putting in, but maybe some, you know, like of making it feel right.
Yeah, it feels
like lost on that. But I don't know. It's I mean, that's
people
fine.
People enjoy it, power to them, I suppose.
Yeah, it's just not my perspective at all. So I definitely, I can't remember where we were with this. Brittany, you did not have like the shame, fear of being naked. This is the point, which is fine.
I think it's not that I didn't have it, because I had it a little bit, mainly because the only people I ever talked to about it are people like you guys or, you know, and I still like don't even really talk about it because I don't have the experience, but it's the fact of knowing it exists. I think even just the knowing is part of it, whether or not you're writing or you're reading or you're doing whatever. I think the fact of knowing it and being like totally fine and thinking that it's normal is almost like, you know, but then again, like sitting down to dinner with your mom, like I'm not telling her about like, you know, all the crazy stuff I see on the internet all day, unless it's like something relatable to her. But being like, so I was in my 100th page of this like ship names tag on Tumblr, and like you would not believe what I saw. Like she doesn't need to know I spent 9 hours doing that one weekend instead of like interacting with real human beings. So like, you know, like just knowing that like, oh, like yes, I'm fine with this and I think it's normal, but then reading about it and being reminded that it's like it is normal to a large group of people, but there are still people who look at it and are like, oh my God, I can't believe this is a thing. You do get that feeling of like, oh, am I not? It's the same feeling of how you found it in the first place of I need to go find somewhere where this exists. And now like, oh my gosh, now people know about it. Like, what am I going to do?
And I think for me, the core factor is not just shipping culture or convention culture. It is the specific idea of the speech that Claire gives when she's teaching Forrest about shipping of sometimes this matters. Like, sometimes this is not just people having a sexy time. Sometimes yeah. this is queer people having a non-heteronormative view of a text that feels like it should be a thing. Yeah. Like yeah. that it should be a thing, and whether that is a cruel intention or a not a real intention, like, you know, whether those people are delusional for reading it that way, you know, and the erasure of that. So I think that idea of like especially of like a genuine queer reading of a show, you know, and then, you know, especially in a world where we're looking at something, there are more things to point to now where we're like, oh, okay, like Hannibal did that. Like Hannibal didn't start like that, and then they saw that that's what it could be, and they decided to go that. And Legend of Korra did that. We did Legend of Korra on
Rewatchables. It's Always Sunny, for example.
Which, yeah, It's Always Sunny did that after 12 years. Like,
after 12 years. And I mean, at the beginning, for those who haven't watched it, Mac's character was kind of – it was like a joke at first that people thought Mac was gay. And then, in season 12, it's like, well, they realize, well, you know what, actually, this is important. This is plausible for his character. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm fairly certain that Rob, who plays Mac, I have a feeling I read somewhere that someone in his family.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Someone is I can't even remember now. I don't want to misrepresent, but I have a feeling that I read that someone in his family is queer. And so he sort of realized, you know, this isn't a joke. This is something that's plausible. We should, you know, make this decision and make it real and make it honest in a way that show often isn't. But it's still like it was bold of them to do when they did it, and they did a great job with it. And it was important that they did it.
And, you know, Britta was talking about like House and Wilson, you know, on House as well, and that kind of thing. So, which I definitely had a bit, like, I was like reading that being like, is that? Yeah. Okay. Like when I first watched House as well.
Drive off into the sunset together.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah. So I think that question, that aspect of, it's not delusional for people who are not heteronormative to read things in characters and where the intention was. I think that aspect of, like, you know, what she was saying, she's like, the difference between like the Riverdale fans who are like shipping canon things, and then you're like, oh no, can't you see that Archie and Jughead are meant to be together? You know, like that kind of thing is like the thing that's like more that it's important and more than just like fun for fandom, you know, it's kind of like, it's more than just, oh, this is a fandom thing that I think is fun. It's kind of like almost defensive to treat that like it's delusional if we're talking about a legitimately, heterosexual lens versus a non-heterosexual lens just in general. And so that being exposed is both great and, for some reason, you know, that should be really validating, but for some reason the fan fiction and fandom aspect of it and stuff also makes me feel very exposed and vulnerable. But anyway, Cass, your hype for the book is nearly this same point in reverse. So do you want to kind of take over from there and lead into that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, basically my hype was that this was the most honest portrayal of fandom and fandom culture that I've ever seen in any popular media. So I read this in one sitting on the flight out of Italy after going to SupCon. So that was the Supernatural convention in Rome.
Is this a plane book? Because I read it on a plane.
Yeah, apparently. So, I mean, I was already really, like, in my feelings about fandom.
And we'd had this experience that I mentioned before where people were there, like, literally intentionally trying to make trouble and be cruel in Q&As to various actors and stuff like that. Mm. Yeah, very bizarre.
It was a weird con.
It was a weird weekend, and then a lot of weird shit. But anyway, yes, carry on.
But yeah, so sort of reading this book where someone experiences like all of the positives and the negatives and the extreme highs and lows of fandom, and you know, seeing an actor go from being like disparaging and sort of even cruel to being accepting and understanding, and a fan
you know, crossing boundaries, which we, as Nat said, we experienced seeing that that weekend, and her growing as well. And all of that was sort of already something that I was like feeling a lot of after that convention. So reading this book, well, yeah, it is sort of the inverse of what Nat was saying, is I just felt very seen. And which is unusual for me, that usually I do not want to be seen. and so in this, but in this instance, I was like, it just hit me. Like I was sitting on that plane. I was sitting on the plane out of Rome, like flying to Abu Dhabi, with this guy sitting next to me. And I was just sobbing. And I just remember he was sort of glancing at me like, are you okay? And I was like, I'm not okay, but it's fine. it just hit me. Like it hit me really hard. I loved being seen in this instance, because it was almost sort of taking things that generally it would be stuff that you're sort of told you should be sort of embarrassed about, like don't discuss shipping, don't discuss, you know, how big of a nerd you are for this fandom in public. And it was sort of, even though by this point in time, like this is obviously earlier this year, by this point in time, I'm like, whatever about it. Like, this is the thing that I love. I've got no shame in it. But there is still that undercurrent of don't talk about it. And this, I don't know, this sort of took that away in a way, if that makes sense. I don't know if you guys sort of felt any of that, like in terms of...
Like, not as intensely personally connected to it, but I definitely... Yeah. Felt like, because I said I went home after having finished this book, and I didn't want to leave that world where people were comfortable with what they loved and like really just dove into it. So I went back to what I had on hand, which was I read Carry On, and I read, which isn't necessarily like, you know, the fan aspect of it. It's just a book, but
it's interesting that situation is very interesting.
And then I read Fangirl because it was sitting next to it. And then I went and obviously downloaded the How to Repair a Mechanical Heart. And by that point I was like, okay, I'm good. Let me get back to a show that I care about. Like I wanted to then go back and like just start watching something that I was passionate about, because I'm like, all right, I've read enough passion. Mm. I'm now ready to like go back and like be the fan. You know what I mean? So it was... It did set off a series, a very odd chain of events, but like it led me back to like being like, okay, cool. Yeah. Now I'm going to go back to watching the thing I like, because these people care about the thing they like, and I'm going to go and enjoy myself.
Yeah.
The one I haven't read yet that I started and was like, oh, I don't know if I can handle this, is Stranger Than Fan Fiction, the Chris Colfer young adult
novel. I refuse to read it.
Okay. You haven't read it yet?
I started.
Okay, well, okay, so he wrote a young adult novel about basically a kid who's on a young adult who's on a popular show, and his experiences, like, I think he gets, like, ends up getting kidnapped slash has to go on a road trip to get somewhere, like, with a bunch of fans, and it's kind of, it's very much like this, like Claire and Forrest, it's a meeting of minds between, like, the fandom and the star, and, like, an undoing of misapprehensions. I read, like maybe 20 pages, and I was like, nope, I can't do it. Like, because it was too, he is a very bitter young man, Chris Colfer, bit of a genius, but bit of a dick, very, very, you know, very amazingly talented. But I knew that this book was just going to be full of projection of the shitty stuff that happened to him. Exactly. And I was not ready for it at all. Yeah. I was like, no, I cried for 8 hours when you won your Golden Globe. I cannot read this book. Like it's going to take a few years for me to like, handle reading this book and see his like, cause he puts a lot of honesty about like his personal experiences and his views on the world into not even just into that kind of book, even into his like children's fairy tale books are like littered with commentary that's like very telling about his attitudes. And it's great, but it's like a lot. And so the Stranger Than Fan Fiction I have not been able to read yet. So I find it not that surprising, Brittany, that you were like, nope, can't
can't do that.
Yeah, as soon as I read what it was about, like, before, you know, like, yeah, it was when it was announced.
I got a digital arc for that from Karen, and I started reading, and I was like, sorry, Karen, I can't do it. But I
do not own it. But again, I agree with what you said. He is a genius, and he's, but you can, having almost, like, you know, grown up with him on Glee,
yeah,
like, this world, like, you get his personality even in the children's.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
This one, I was like, I'm staying as far away from it as possible because, A, going into it, you know what you're going to read. Like, even if you don't know the plot of the story and the characters and stuff, there's a tone that is very evident. So I was like, you know what? This is, like, blurring a lot of lines that I can get away with when you're writing about Mother Goose, but I can't get away with you writing about a character that's loosely related to yourself. So,
yeah. And it's not like the kind of stuff, you know, it's not exactly like, oh, it's going to shatter the illusion or anything. Right. It's just like, it's not like, oh, it's going to, like, ruin the glory that is Glee, because Glee ruined itself.
Glee ruined Glee.
Much before that. It's just really stressful to read something like that about someone. Like,
it's just something I don't need added to anything. Like, I have no problem with him right now. Like, I don't need anything added. I'm fine without it. I'm not suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Anyway, but yes, it's so that one is an interesting, like, flip side to Ship It. I'd say it's probably the closest comparison to Ship It in a flip side way is Stranger Than Fan Fiction, but I have not managed to actually prove that because I cannot read it. So interesting. Very interesting. Like I said, like, Ship It should definitely be something that everyone who touches a fandom in every way should read, I think. Like, like, you know, fans.
Yeah, definitely actors. I feel like Forrest's entire journey through this was among the most validating things, I think, in it.
Yeah.
Seeing Forrest's growth, basically, was really validating, I think. And just seeing everybody growing and learning that the other side has good intentions, even if it's not immediately understandable to them. That was just really important to me, I think.
Britta definitely talked a lot about, like, how she didn't want really to write, like, wish fulfillment. Like, she didn't want to write, like, a guidebook to, like, how to make this happen in your fandom, you know, which is, like, a huge problem, like, with people, like, threatening, like, you know, like, that's definitely been, like, a thing. But Forrest's arc is pretty big wish fulfillment for certain actors.
Yeah.
That is a very wonderful lesson, I think, that, you know, and like I said, it's definitely something, like, that I seek out fandoms, or not seek out, it's usually it catches my attention.
Yeah.
I don't, like, go looking, like, hunting for fandoms, but it catches my attention, like, through internet osmosis when a fandom has, like, the creative players, like the actors and writers who have a really good attitude towards fandom. So, yeah. Yeah, so speaking of that, Brittany, how about you tell us about your hype then of the book?
So I think I kind of touched on it mostly. It was just like feeling like I was in the same position as Rico for most of the book, because, you know, you're watching certain people who are, like, sort of aware that things exist but don't know much about them come to understand what actually goes into fandom from a fan perspective, and then also are so, like, you know, learning the ropes of, like, what actually goes into the production half of it. And I liked that Britta included this very neutral character who was a guide for multiple people in the group, like how to handle the PR people, you know, dealing with the newbie actor, and how to comfort the newer actor around fans and around, like, you know, not only just, like, shuffling, physically moving people from, like, stage to whatever, and being like, you can't talk like that, like, you know, like, but having, like, a good, like, he's just a good guy. Like, you know, he wasn't malicious or trying to get things done. He's like, when he had to be real about the way things work from either a production or a fan side, he just said it. And he's like, this is the way things are. If you roll with the punches and you appreciate what everyone in their job is doing and are willing to work together, like, you know, he was just like a very zen and real voice. And I felt very deeply bonded with him because he was able to do all the things that I want to say and can never do. Like being like, would, but you don't see this side of it. And I'm like, okay, but I would be yelling. Whereas
I would love anything, like a chapter, a fucking side novel from his perspective, because he's definitely the most interesting character, like, throughout the book. Obviously, one of the golden characters. The other one to me is Katie, the PR assistant, who is like secretly in the fandom, which is becoming much more common. Like, a lot of the you know, the younger the people are working in the industry, the more likely it is that fandom was normalized for them. So, like, mid-20s girl. Like, I know a few people, like, in the industry who are in fandoms. Like, Britta herself, obviously, is a TV writer who comes from TV show fandoms. And I know that she's in a group of – she is, like, a group of friends who – or, like, they are, like, a collective, like, a book club, you know, that I've seen, like, pictures from a party they had, which is all different, like, people who are, like, assistants on shows and, like, you know, all that kind of thing, who are all, like, fandom people who, like, ship things, if you know what I mean. And they have, like, a collective of people who have crossed that stream. Yeah. And so I love Katie as a representation of that and her, like, you know, that she's kind of, like, she's pushing people in the direction that she thinks is best, both from the perspective of someone who gets it, like, because she ships Smoke Art, you know, she's like, yeah, totally, I feel like that should have been how the show went as well. And, you know, so yes, I will definitely encourage you in that direction, you know, doused with the reality of it. And I think it's, yeah, so she was great. But Rico is just a wonderful, balanced character. And he reminds me a lot of Misha. There's a lot of Misha in him. And there's a lot of, like, Nathan Fillion, like, in him in terms of, like, the enthusiasm for, like, the fan communities and being at conventions and, like, genuinely, like, being, you know, like, that kind of fanboy. So he's great. And, yes, he definitely is, you know, you need a couple of characters in a book like this that are the kind of, not can do no wrong, but, like, the you know, the ones that, you know, you that don't have to have that growth of terribleness to greatness. And he's a pretty fantastic. So
he's definitely a hype on his own, I think.
He is.
Just in and of himself.
So him as a character would have been my singular hype. Though there are many, but given the tie-in, the other is the moment that really that really made me kind of cry in the book the first time. So my hype was that moment at the convention, at, you know, one of the first conventions where Rico does introduce Forrest to the environment and they have that really pure fan interaction with the two girls that are not Claire, the two random girls that recognize them, who are real people in the Supernatural fandom. I know who those people are based on.
Yeah.
But that portrayal of, like, what a good fan interaction actually is and should be was very special. That, and, like, you know, him showing that to Forrest and him and Forrest kind of learning, oh, like, that's why it matters. Like, that's really, you know, important. So that was the moment that really, you know, many moments in the book make me feel a lot of things, like the, you know, especially the climax at the San Diego Comic-Con panel. But that moment of, like, basically, like, you know, the what to do versus, like, what not to do in other parts of the book was such an amazing moment for me, and, you know, on so many levels, like, such a dream of how it should be when it's right, that I just loved it. So him and that portrayal being written down on paper was a huge, huge highlight for me.
I just realized, Natalie,
that
I bought my copy of this book when I was with you.
With me, yeah.
I just realized that
Strand in New York. And that was the same day, actually, that Britta was having her release party in LA. Like, you purchased your copy at the same time that the book was having its release party in LA. So that's a nice.
I bought my copy at Comic-Con.
Well, and the copy you first read is twins with Britney's, because we bought physical copies at the Strand together. So we bought it together.
Yeah, you were like, I need to buy a copy for someone. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll get my copy now too, since I'm here.
And then, because I had the e-book from the publisher because we reviewed it. I bought a physical copy, lent it with you in New York, lent it to Cass. And then in Rome. In Rome. And then she read it on the way home and then posted it back to me. And then she bought her own copy of Comic Con. So, yeah, it's all very circular. Wonderful.
It is. Everything.
So we'll close up our episode in the way that we normally do. We'll have a two truths and a lie from Cass about her experiences. And then we've got a question of the day to finish us off. And that's from Britta herself, has sent in a question of the day for us to address on this podcast about her book. So unless anyone has anything further they want to say about Ship It, we'll move on. But yeah.
No, I'm excited to move on, mainly because it's like the first time I don't know the other host. So I will like definitely have an actual challenge here.
Okay. Well, in that case, I will do my truths and a lie.
Oh, good.
Okay. I started the Dean Cass Pine Fest because I selfishly wanted more Dean Cass longfic, and that's the only reason I started it. I am engaged in real life because of the Buffy fandom. And third, my first foray into fanfic was because my screenwriting teacher told me it might help to emulate writing dialogue of existing shows, which is something I was struggling with.
I mean, I assume the first is true, but can you please, like, make a caveat to, like, make it, like, canon-verse longfic? Because why is no one writing that for me? Like, I just don't understand why people are so... But, like, you're only one person and not enough people do. So I assume that's true because it sounds like something that you would do. Because you're just greedy and terrible.
That's precisely me.
I don't know. So, you know, feel free to you can ask some more questions. It's interesting that you make the point about the screenwriting because, like, obviously, like, Fangirl by Rambo Rowell, I'm not sure if you've read it yet, it has a very different interpretation of fandom. Mm. True in other ways, but different. And she has a big, like, blow up at her college with that. So if you have really had a teacher that said something like that, that's a nice change.
Well, I haven't read that book, but I've got it sitting on my shelf. I've been meaning to read it since it came out. I just haven't got around to it.
It has a different perspective on fandom, but very very, very truthful, but a very different, like I said in the interview with Britta, like different lessons like learned from it. So I don't know about Sarah. Like, I don't know what would have sparked your
first
interactions.
I have a feeling it's that one, but it's not. The lie is the Buffy part. Like, it could be another show.
Yeah, well, like, I know that's the thing, because I know Sarah, and I know that you're both in the Supernatural fandom, but I have no idea, like, what else it might have been, like, on the internet that was, like, that you were talking about. Like, so I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. So your final guess is then.
My guess is also a twist on Sarah, but I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you were right. So that one was the lie. We started talking online because we're both super big Dean Cass shippers in the Supernatural fandom. That's how we met. And yeah, so now I'm engaged in real life because of Dean and Cass.
I knew all of those facts. I just didn't know if that's how you first started talking or not.
That was my trickery and deceit in my sneaky lie.
We love two truths and a twist. Don't worry. Like, we're all very bad at lying, so we always end up with two truths and a twist.
Yeah, hide the lie and the truth. It was definitely true that I started the Pinefest purely for selfish reasons. I was like, I've read all of the longfic, And I want more. And waiting every year for the Dean Cast Big Bang was like agony. I just wanted more now. So I was like, you know what? I'll start my own fanfic challenge. And I can put rules in place so that it's fic that I want to read. And it's worked out so far. Wow. I've done 2 years of it. This is the third year. I co-run it with Mittens, who is fairly popular on Tumblr as well and on AO3 as a meta and fic writer. But yeah, so that's worked out pretty well as a selfish endeavor.
Are you submitting this year or just running it?
I'm not sure. I may submit this year. It just depends on time, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, whether I finish something for it or not is up in the air at this stage.
Where's my next chapter of Isosceles?
I actually was planning to edit it today, so I will after
I've... I can't believe I've shot myself in the foot like this.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I will be editing that today. So it's soon.
Good. Good.
Also, Fortress is the next chapter of it.
Oh, I actually haven't read the last. I was like, remember I said to you, like, I was like, yeah, I can't like do that right now.
Oh yeah.
I still haven't done it. So if you have a next chapter coming that's not that point of view, then I will read them together when you post
the next one. Yeah, definitely.
Cool. All right.
And yeah, the other truth, my screenwriting teacher did in fact tell me that. So I was having a lot of concerns that I was not going to be able to accurately emulate the voices of characters that already existed. And given that I would like ultimately I want to work in TV as a writer. And so I said to her, I'm like, how can I work on this? And she was like, try writing fan fiction. That was flat out her exact words.
That's so awesome. I did.
Yeah. So that was when I first started writing fan fiction. And it was like, it was Sherlock fan fiction at the time. I was into that show.
Brittany's into Sherlock in all ways.
In all ways.
I was really into it. I did publish a bit of it back in the days of fanfiction.net. I think I deleted it all because I became quite ashamed of it. It wasn't particularly good. And I sort of fell out of the show quite a lot. So I like completely deleted all evidence of it. But that was my first foray into fanfic. And yeah, the rest is history.
That's rad. Did Megan text you about Elementary at all, Brittany? Because she's very involved now.
No,
I don't know when she mainlined it all, but I meant to
message her about it because you were like, you were having a conversation that I wanted to have with someone when I was watching it. And again, there was nowhere for me to have that conversation.
You should text her because I still haven't seen it. I just know about Clyde, so I do want to see it though.
Yeah, talk about getting into a show based on a GIF. Like, I didn't even know Elementary was happening, and I love all like Sherlock as an entity, like Conan Doyle Sherlock, all the way through. Like Cumberbatch's Sherlock is great, but I had watched like the old Sherlock, like forever. So like when Elementary,
Jeremy Brent and stuff.
Yeah. Jeremy Brent, and you know. Like, there's one on every Saturday or Sunday morning at 11 on TV. So good. but anyway, I didn't even know CBS because I didn't really watch anything on CBS, nor was I, like, when Elementary started, I wasn't, like, paying attention to any new Sherlock adaptations. It just, like, and with Johnny Lee Miller was in it, which blew my mind because Thanksgiving is one of my favorite movies of all time. And, like, how did this show not end up on my radar until literally midway through season 2, and I was on Tumblr and someone posted a GIF of Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu having a conversation. I'm like, what is this? And I'm like, oh my God, Johnny Lee Miller, Sherlock, what am I doing with my life? And I literally did not leave my house the following weekend. And I watched a season and a half and then was like counting down the minutes until the new episode came on. And I love a good procedural. So like it was so good. And I think that the B stories on that show are just incredible. And I've interviewed Rob Darity, who is the showrunner and creator. It's just, they're all so wonderful. I interviewed actually the whole cast because I went to a Paley Fest with them. And that was a lot for me to handle talking to Johnny Lee Miller.
So, yeah.
That was like a freak out while also being like not being professional because I couldn't hold myself together during that one.
What did you do?
I asked my question, but it was very shaky. Like normally if I have to ask questions, like I get them done. But I was just like, I'm talking to my internal monologue was like, sick boy, sick boy, sick boy, sick boy. And I was like,
speaking of people that should have been life partners. But anyway,
please, they are life partners. Did you see Trainspotting too? They're life partners.
Yes, we talked about it so much. Yes. Anyway, okay. Yeah, it's good. I do have to watch it. I feel like it will be very enjoyable to us. So, yeah. Okay, so we're going to finish up with question of the day sent in by Britta, and then we've got our high conclusion to finish off. So Britta has sent the question to us for this episode, question of the day, saying, what two characters from different shows or movies or books do you ship, as in like a crossover pairing? I'll start by saying I don't have massive amount of like I said, like I sort of end up shipping things for watching them develop organically. I only really have one hardcore ship that I love, like the fan fiction of, that is not in any way canon, as in the characters have never engaged with each other in canon, but that's still from the same fandom.
Yeah, so, I know exactly which one you're talking about.
But I have a lot of thoughts about like characters that I want to meet from like different shows and stuff, so that could develop. And the biggest one that springs to my mind, that I like two people that I want to watch an episode with these people together and see what happens, is Angel from Angel and Dean Winchester from Supernatural. Because I would just, when we were watching Angel on the rewatch, he also drives it's not an Impala, it's like a, it's another like black muscle car of the same era, and there was just, I waxed lyrical about this on the show for some time, but I just want to see them both being pathetic together, because Angel and Dean are both characters that have a lot of ridiculous qualities to them when not taking their job seriously, like when they're dealing with their own personal life. They're both ridiculous in similar ways, and that may not make for the best ship, but it would make for a very entertaining television. And so I'd love to see that. And then my other is another Dean crossover situation. And honestly, it could be a ship. But it's mainly a different thing, is that I would like Harry Styles, of Harry Styles being One Direction, to be Dean Winchester's life coach / possibly... You know, but yeah, like I feel like that his like sense of self and his like confidence in his place in the world and his sort of innate calmness is something that like he would just be a great therapist for many people, but especially for Dean for a variety of reasons. So that's something I've thought like an inordinate amount, like about like a self-help book written by Harry Styles with like all of these things that would like help Dean's life. So, yeah, that's definitely one that I would have a lot of fun with. And I'm sure there's other characters that I've been like, oh, yeah, this person. I know my friend Maria is writing a Harry Potter fan fiction that involves, like, Remus Lupin in his lost, like, college years, like, you know, like, traveling and interacting with Supernatural in some way. So that could also be a very interesting character dynamic. But I don't know.
It's actually hilarious to me that you mentioned the Dean and the Harry Styles as his life coach thing, because what I jotted down earlier when you mentioned this question was Dean Winchester and any therapist ever. Because again, like you, I find it very difficult.
Like Hannibal. Like imagine
I specifically wrote maybe not Hannibal. because similar to you, I don't tend to ship things unless I've seen those characters interact, because any shipping that I do really stems from their interactions in the canon, and without sort of seeing two people interact, I just am incapable of shipping it. I've jotted down characters that I'd like to meet, which was literally Dean Winchester and any therapist ever, because I feel like he really could benefit from talking things out. And being in a situation where he's free and safe to do so. And the other one that I'd also jotted down was also, again, not a ship, which is Dean Winchester again and Adam Parrish of the Ravens. I know, I hear you gasping. From the Raven Cycle. Yeah. I just feel like they would have a lot to learn from each other. And they are very... Yeah, I just feel like they would learn a lot from each other. So those are mine.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Blue would be one of his extra collections
of teenage
girlfriends. Dean, you'll see as you watch the show, Brittany, Dean has a lot of friends who are teenage girls. He's a good peer to teenage girls in a weird, very strange
way. I mean, I could see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, Dean is an interesting character because he is so thoroughly drawn and has existed for so many years and is so open about some things and not about others that he's a good mix to throw into he's a good character to throw in any situation and see how people react to him. So but yes, Brittany, have you got any thoughts about this question or this concept?
I do, but again, it's less of a shipping and more of a like it could end up being a ship, who knows, you know. Retirement comes for both of these men, but I want to see, let's backtrack. I want to see two different series starring I got it. I know exactly. I just talked myself into it and it will be a ship. I want young Tenzin and Ripper Giles to have a series together. And I want them to grow up into the men that they become, but together.
My God.
So the angsty Tenzin being the son of Aang and, you know, brooding. He meets Ripper, who's, like, in his pure rebellious phase, but then Ripper, like, becomes a watcher, and then Tenzin was, like, taking over the Air Temple. And, you know, then they go on vacation together, and they just read a lot of books. And it's wonderful.
Yep,
that's
definitely
it.
Important. Oh my god,
that's what I want. Those are all of my favorite things.
We're definitely gonna have to bring that over to Rewatchable about crossover characters because that is a lot. Oh my god,
I will die on this hill.
What? Yeah, but what about Ripper Tenzin meeting Lin Beifong? Like that fight. You don't want to see that fight.
That girl gang. Can you imagine walking up to that in a hallway? Like you would turn around and move.
Oh my god! And they both protect their wimpy little friend Tenzin. Oh my god. Okay. Jesus Christ. Okay. Great. All right. Well, thank you for that image. I feel like there are characters, especially Harry Potter, like especially when Harry Potter was so all-encompassing, you know, in various ways, that there are definitely like character archetypes that I feel like people should meet. Like, you know, like I love crossover concepts. Like I love the conversations of like people writing of like Bucky talking to Diana Prince about their respective like terrible Steve idiots and stuff like that. So I do love thinking about crossovers that will work. I don't know if I've thought of like a made for each other pairing that would work from two crossovers, but conceptually I love the idea of crossovers that work. All right, well, that's all. We've gone, you know, hopefully this isn't like a total drag to get through as we've gone a bit over time, but we'll finish up with the traditional Not About the Weather haiku. So, Brittany, did you write this while we were recording?
Of course I did.
Yeah, this is Brittany's major forte is composing poetry on the fly for our conclusions. So would you like to read it and see us out for the night?
Sure. So this week's haiku conclusion is love it or hate it. Fandom is complicated. Smoke heart five Eva.
I mean, yes. It fits. So it thank does. You very much. So I hope everyone enjoyed that. You can get ship it in hard copy form, and you can get an audiobook form available this week as well, or ebook form as well. And you can reach Britta at Britta Ships It on Twitter as well, and tell her what you thought of the book or what you thought of our interview. So thank you so much to her for being so open and putting this out into the world, and to Cass and Brittany for talking about these crazy things that are becoming more and more normal. So, you know, one of the little interesting factors, I won't go on too much of a tangent, that we mentioned in the interview was like the portrayal of young people in other media, and how common it is to portray them as fandom loving people, like, you know, like on a teen show or something like that. And it's going to be very interesting to see how like the world adapts to that as it does become more all encompassing for like a part of being how kids watch television now. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything that, you know, any thoughts about that, but it's definitely been done badly in the past. So I'm curious to see how it changes when that's not actually the focus, but when someone is a big fan of things as a side character or whatever. But yeah, thank you all. And we will see you all soon with another edition of Not About the Weather. So bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.